thank you so much for that great song. I love the song. It is the theme song to the Hal Ginsberg Morning Show, written many years ago. Art and Delana, one of my loyalist listeners, the family there in Seaside and the rock band that they are. Thank you guys so much for the song, which I continue to play. I mean, the problem is it's Monterey. I'm not really in Monterey. I'm actually going to talk about where I live now today a little bit. Kind of proud of my home county, Montgomery County, standing up to the bullies of ICE, going into the school systems, going to the schools throughout our region, the DMV, they call it, the District, Maryland, and Virginia, the DMV. And in Maryland, the county council, the county executive, Isaiah Leggett, said, forget about it. You're not coming in. You're not going to pull kids out and detain them. And this is what I like to see from my local leaders. This is just really troubling, isn't it? We've got the federal government, the Democratic president, his executive branch is going out there and pulling kids, little kids, out of public schools. And I don't know what they're doing, detaining them, saying these people are not supposed to be here. And I am really disheartened by that. I will talk about the president's speech, of course, the State of the Union. I thought he did a good job. He always does. He's always good. But you know what? I'll be honest with you, I didn't watch it. I watched a lot of it this morning. I prepared for the show, but I didn't watch it live. My wife watches. She said he did a good job. He always does a good job. But, you know, it doesn't excite me anymore. He's been president for 8 years. I remember when he first was elected, and I loved the speech, the speechifying, so articulate. He says the right thing beautifully. But I'm at that point where Hillary Clinton was back in 2008. Enough with the speeches. Enough with the rallies. Let's have some concrete action. And where I am most disappointed with action is what I just told you right now. Now, he talked about the TPP. I don't like the TPP. But where I am most disappointed right now, is this executive action going after immigrants, often women and children who fled violence in Honduras, in Guatemala, in Nicaragua, and they are being rounded up and herded back to countries where the kids especially may have no knowledge, never been. They may not speak the language. They certainly may not speak this dialect in the villages where they may be having to live. This is just not right. And I think the president's making a big mistake authorizing all this, especially in an election year. I just don't get it. So my wife, she's a public school teacher. She teaches ESOL, English to speakers of other languages. So she has many children in her classroom who are from Latin America. And as far as she knows, they're all in this country legally. But she doesn't know for a fact. One of the teachers with whom she works, Alejandra, probably shouldn't say names, is here legally. I believe she's American. Alejandra's an American, but her family is from a Latin American country, and her mom is up visiting from the country where she lives, not to stay. She's got all the right paperwork. She's here on a vacation visa, and she brought a granddaughter with her, who is going to school here now. She's also here on not a permanent visa, but a long-term visa. She's allowed to go to school. It's all legal. She was told in class yesterday to expect, not her personally, not this girl personally, not the niece of a teacher that my wife works with. She wasn't taken aside and said, by the way, the ICE agents are coming to our school. Instead, the school itself sent out an announcement to all the kids, hey, just so you know, we are expecting a raid. I don't think use the word raid. We are expecting ICE agents to come to our school tomorrow and to take some kids out of class. Does someone want to explain why this is the right thing for a Democratic president to be doing? You know it's the president doing it. He is the chief law enforcement officer. I want to give you really beautiful response by the county executive of Montgomery County, Maryland, Isaiah Leggett. Ike Leggett. So here's what the executive said. Our nation, this was yesterday, he released this. Actually, he released it Monday evening, but it was given to the schools Tuesday. Our nation faces a significant humanitarian challenge in how we deal with the thousands of children and families fleeing violence in Central America. Certain current conditions in El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras merit granting special temporary protection to these children and parents who have legitimate reason to fear for their lives if returned to their countries. We recognize that the recently announced federal policy is narrowly crafted to apply only to those who have been issued final orders of removal by an immigration court. But the obvious truth is that many of these children and parents have not had adequate legal representation in these proceedings. No deportations should take place without ensuring that the person to be deported received adequate representation and due process of law under our Constitution. I want you to think about what Ike Leggett said, and how much more compassionate that is than what we heard from Cruz yesterday when he was talking earlier this month to an Iowa dreamer who said, "Hey, I'm afraid if you become president, you're going to send me away from the only home I've ever known, the only community I've ever known." And you know what Cruz said? "Darn right I am. Darn right I will. That's exactly right." So just compare that. Some of our local representatives, our local elected leaders, are so much more caring and decent and humane than that Cruz thing. Imagine being a teenager. See, now this is where you see the differences with a Cruz, from a Republican, from a Trump. The power of imagination. Ike Leggett gets it. He can put himself in the shoes a 15-year-old, a 16-year-old, he can imagine how awful it must be to face a hostile law enforcement that is prepared to take you away, to send you to a strange land. Imagine being a teenager in a formal process in a forbidding setting in a strange land where they speak a language you do not understand. What chance would you have? These children and parents deserve an opportunity to have their cases presented properly as they seek refuge in our nation. For those ordered to be deported after receiving due process, no deportation should take place unless the federal government guarantees legally required family reunification and support to help them live in their own country safely. Failure to guarantee these essential protections is unthinkable, as it will deliver them back to the very violence and human trafficking that caused many to flee to the United States. And Leggett goes on to say that the county has directed the federal enforcement officers to stay out of the schools, that they will not, and they have received assurance that based on the pushback from the local authorities, they will stay out of the schools. It just shows you that sometimes right does beat might. All right, we got a break. I'll come back. I want to talk about the president's speech. It's all coming up on the morning show, the State of the Union. A lot about the Democratic primaries. Really interesting news. I mean, the trend, the pro-Bernie trend continues. It's all coming up on the morning show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
They're working you 12 hours a day at $12 an hour. You don't have time to spend with your family.
Selma, Alabama, Lear worker and union activist Latasha Irby. Irby and co-workers started efforts to organize a UAW local at the multinational Lear Corp's Selma Auto Parts plant in May of 2014. The company immediately started violating labor law with what the National Labor Relations Board says were illegal threats and intimidation tactics in captive audience meetings that workers were forced to attend.
Showing slideshows telling us that if we ever get the union in our plant, that our plant would close down, and that our customer, Hyundai and Montgomery, wouldn't want to accept our parts, and if we ever went to apply for another job, and they saw that we come from a unionized plant, that they wouldn't want to hire us.
Latasha says that she's unintimidated, and here's what she will keep fighting to achieve.
I want to see the workers get a livable wage and a safer work environment. I just want them to be able to have a voice in their workplace, a voice about issues that concerns the worker themselves, as opposed to the company always changing things to fit their agenda. They said we're a family and we work together, we're a team, so why not come together as a team and value our opinion just as much as you want us to value your opinion.
The Nevada State AFL-CIO hosted a Raising Wages Summit on Tuesday. Workers, activists, and labor leaders came together in Las Vegas to discuss how they can work together to improve the lives of all Nevada working families. Danny Thompson, Executive Secretary Treasurer of the Nevada AFL-CIO, says wages have been stagnant for a long time and working people need to come together and demand higher wages. And that message needs to go out to both Republican and Democratic candidates.
Wages in America are stagnant. As our productivity as workers has gone up, wages have gone the other way. We wanted to shine a light on that, get people fired up and involved. It's not just about billionaires who can buy elections. It's about low-wage workers who need help and who are working every day and can't afford to live.
Workers Independent News is heard daily on The Rick Smith Show, live 3 to 6 p.m. coast to coast at thericksmithshow.com. The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
WIN is made possible in part by the United Steelworkers.
Workers Independent News is brought to you by the 50,000 members of the Association of Flight Attendants, CWA, representing aviation's first responders and last line of defense, charged with the safety, health, and security of the passengers in their... Safety, pay.
That's for listener Jack, not Catholic Jack, another listener Jack. He was not happy with my, and I don't think I criticize Bowie at all. I don't think I say anything negative about Bowie. I was very positive about Bowie. I think his influence has been extraordinary. He has a tremendous body of work. He's an incredible talent. He's, you know, one of the, you know, I don't know, top 10, top 20 in rock history. No question about it. But I said, you know, he didn't really grab me. You know, he wasn't a guy like when I was a kid, I loved Chuck Berry. I think he had Chuck Berry's Golden Hits. If you remember that album, it's like a black cover and it shows Berry doing that duck walk he did with a guitar. And he was on the kind of duck walking. I loved that. Loved Buddy Holly. I play him all the time. The Beatles a little later. I never had that kind of affection. It wasn't inside of me like some of those other artists like Bowie. When I got a little older and I really got into, you know, maybe more contemporary music, The Clash. I loved that album, London Calling, when I was, you know, a junior and senior in high school. Maybe it was just senior, 80, I guess. 79. So junior, senior, yeah. I was really into the new wave scene. I don't know, punk, new wave. I wasn't, for whatever reason, Bowie, he just never was front and center for me. I love the Stones. So Jack didn't like that. Jack was, I guess, you know, a little bit hurt. He said, I love Bowie. Why doesn't hell get it? So he messaged me, I believe it was a message, hey, play some Bowie duets. So I just did, that is great, Bowie and Mick Jagger. By the way, Bowie, he doesn't even know, do you say it Bowie, do you say it Bowie? He didn't even know himself, because remember, he made the name up. He wasn't called David Bowie as a kid. He was called David Jones. But he couldn't be Davy Jones because there was already Davy Jones. So I played that. I'll try to play some more duets. I love that. That is great. I remember that from, I guess it was MTV. And they look so good. You know, when I watched, I remember in the early 80s, I guess, when that came out, Dancing in the Street, that duet, obviously it's a Martha Reeves song originally. They were old guys to me. I was a kid, right? I was maybe 20. If I have the year right, I don't know. Could be wrong. Something around that time, 82, 83, something like that, they came out. So they were 19, 20, 21. And these guys were probably late 30s. If I did the math right. Yeah, probably that's about right. They look so young to me now. And Jagger looks great. He's bouncing around even more than Bowie. I guess, you know, Jagger must have not just, he just didn't do the drugs and the booze the way everyone else, because he just maintained that youthful figure. All right, let's get back to the politics. I'll play you some more Sad to Say. I love that. Yeah, Jack, it's great. What do you want me to say? I love it. It's great. They're great. It's just not, for me, quite as moving. It just doesn't, you know, rock my world. As much as I can appreciate it, it just at a slightly lower level. It's not Quadrophenia. That rocked my world. That, you know, does it for me. Led Zeppelin 4, that does it for me. Not Bowie, just, he's like a B+. Those guys were A's. For me, just for me on the Ginsburg scale. On the Ginsburg grading scale, nothing in the least bit negative about Bowie. And I'll play some more Bowie. I like Bowie. It's not like I don't like Bowie. I just don't love him. That's the difference. I just don't love him. It's kind of like, I'm starting to like Hillary. Isn't that amazing? Because I have been so critical, so negative about her. By the way, and when I say, look, they're all these bands, like they had some junky songs and, you know, they did excesses and they were abusive and all that. We can all criticize all of them. And, you know, if you want to go through some kind of meta-analysis, maybe one artist really is better than another. It's kind of, in a sense, who you like better. I really love Bernie. I think he's better for America. I'm trying as hard as possible to be objective. I have not felt warm and fuzzy towards Hillary in any way. But the fact is, as she has slid in the polls, I'm starting to like her a little bit better and feeling like, you know, in a tiny way, in a few areas, she's getting a slight raw deal. I was going to write about that yesterday because I do think her plan, by the way, for a Family Leave Act is better. How she would fund it, the guaranteed family. I've talked about this. I think her plan is better than the Sanders, Rosa DeLauro, Elizabeth Warren plan or Sherrod Brown plan, whoever it is who is pushing it first in the Senate. Rosa DeLauro's the very, very progressive Connecticut congresswoman who I think is awesome. I mean, I think she's great. My mom talks about her a lot, and she's awesome. She's as good as they get. By the way, talk about someone I'd like to see run for president, Rosa DeLauro. But I think Clinton has the better argument. How do we fund Family Leave Act? I think it should be a tax on all Americans, and specifically a progressive tax on the wealthiest. I don't think it should be based on a payroll tax and matching contributions from employers. I think that's too burdensome on small businesses. It is, let me say it a different way. It may not be too burdensome. It's perhaps better. It's almost certainly better than the status quo. But if we can avoid putting yet another burden on small business people and on wage earners, let's do it. We don't need to fund the Family Leave Act with a surcharge on paychecks, with a surcharge on employers and withholding from employees. We don't need to do it, so let's not do it. All right, phone number here, 844-4-HELG, 844-367-4254. I like Hillary better on guns. And I mean, there's no question she's better on guns. A Brady coalition for the Brady Bill endorses her, and Bill Press seemed genuinely a little surprised by that. How could you be surprised? Senator Sanders voted against the Brady bill like 6-7 times. He never voted for it, didn't vote in favor of it. He voted against liability for gun makers. Clinton has been on the correct side of this issue from the beginning. She's better on guns. How could Press be surprised that a single issue organization, the Brady Coalition, or whatever they're called, I guess a coalition, is it the Brady Coalition? I don't even know what they call themselves. I'm all confused. How could press be in the least bit surprised that the Jim Brady campaign to prevent gun violence would endorse Clinton? Of course they will. She's better on guns. That's their bailiwick. That's their area. That's their only area. Now, I vote on more than one area. If I was a single issue voter on guns only, I'd vote for Clinton. If I was a single issue voter on only the best way to fund family leave, I'd vote for Clinton because I think she's right. I think it's the money to pay for people to take time off to take care of their families, to have a baby and then stay home with a baby for 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 months. I think that should come from the taxpayers as a whole, because we as a society all benefit from it rather than from a small business that is just trying to stay alive. But those aren't the only two issues. On virtually every other issue I can think of, Sanders is better. So I support Sanders. But I am feeling a little bit of sympathy for Clinton. I think she's getting a little bit of a raw deal. I mean, for press to be surprised that the Brady campaign endorsers makes no sense. And I also think she's getting a raw deal because of her view on the Family Leave Act. People are saying, well, why don't you support the DeLauro plan? Well, she doesn't support it because it's not as good as her plan. Now, I was going to write about this. I was going to also put in how I have some sympathy for Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who I think has gotten a bit of unfair criticism. I talked about this as well, for her saying that millennial women, she didn't use the word millennial. She said women, this was in the New York Times magazine over the weekend, women who have come of age since Roe v. Wade was passed, maybe are a little complacent about choice. I mean, why that is in any way controversial is beyond me. I was going to write about how I support her making that statement and how she should not be challenged for it. Also, I wanted to do that because she's perceived in the public eye, and I think correctly so, as a dyed-in-the-wool Clinton supporter. And she gets criticized for that, and certainly from the left. And I've criticized her for that. But this is piling on. This is picky. This is, oh my God, how could you say that about millennials, that they're complacent? Well, she didn't say that. She said women who have not known a world without Roe v. Wade are complacent. And I think that's a fair statement. I think she's unfairly being criticized. And she didn't say it in a way that, as her critics have argued, implies that women who support Sanders are complacent. That was not what she was saying. So I was prepared to defend her. Also, I think those who say she's in the tank for Hillary because of the debate schedule have a point. On the other hand, look, the debate schedule has really, we can't deny it's helped Bernie. He's ahead in both Iowa and New Hampshire now. I think 3 of 4 polls, am I right about, I could be wrong, I would look that up, at least 2 out of 3, maybe 3 out of 4 now, all show him ahead in Iowa. That hasn't been the case before. Okay, so Quinnipiac has Sanders +5 in Iowa. Let me look this up. PPP, which we've talked about, is a biased pro-Clinton polling outfit. I don't take them that seriously, PPP, because they do business with, they take money from Clinton Super PAC, correct the record. All right, so I said 3 out of 4. No. 2 out of the last 3 polls show Sanders up. And I think the 2 more reliable ones, not that ARG American Research Group is great, but Quinnipiac is reliable. They have Sanders now up by 5. So that was what came out yesterday. Big news. And then ARG has him by 3. It's basically a dead heat in Iowa. But Sanders has all the momentum. Also, the New York Times yesterday has Sanders within 7. That's big. Nationally. So, without any debates in the past few weeks. No debates are in the rearview mirror right now, correct? The last debate was before a week before Xmas, almost a month ago now, over 3 weeks ago. We have seen this. Sanders rebounds well after debates are forgotten. The debates have not been Sanders' friend. So anyone who thinks Debbie Wasserman Schultz was doing a favor for Hillary is wrong when Wasserman Schultz, you know, presented a reduced debate schedule and put the debates on days when nobody was going to watch them. Whatever her intent was, it has helped Sanders. So, I think we got to lay off of her. I'm all about effect, about function. Whatever the goal was, the impact of fewer debates on days and times when nobody watches has helped Bernie Sanders. All right, phone number here, 844-4-HELL-G, 844-367-4254. I'm going to get to the State of the Union, I'm sorry. By the way, at 10 o'clock East Coast, 7 Pacific, I will be interviewing, got a guest. No, Jeff says you have no guest. Jeff, this is a guest you'll want to hear, and if you're not listening right now, you know, when I'm speaking live, check it out on the recording. Mike Petrilli from the Hoover Institute, conservative guys over there, Stanford. And he thinks this Friedrichs case, which will make it, if it goes the way conservatives want, if the five conservative Republican justices line up, school unions will no longer be able to assess fees if union members, if people who are part of the collective bargaining unit decide they want to opt out. And they can't collect any fees, not just fees, not reduced fees to pay for the collective bargaining, for which there's no doubt all teachers benefit. They all benefit from having their salaries collectively bargained. Now, Petrilli's going to argue that point. I think he's going to lose that argument. No, he won't think he's lost. I think he's wrong. But I want to hear what he has to say. We'll talk to him in a little over a half hour. We'll talk about the Friedrichs case. I'm looking forward to that. In the next segment, I promise, talk about the State of the Union. But I just wanted to say, hey, I'm feeling a little bit of sympathy for Hillary. You know, this is not going to be a bash Hillary campaign. I lost that sympathy, I have to tell you, when she sent Chelsea out to lie about Sanders on health care. That did not sit well with me. But the slight sense that she has gotten a raw deal lingers. So I have just a bit of sympathy. Less than I had because she sent Chelsea out to lie, but some. Let's go to Media Matters. We'll do the market report. We'll talk about the State of the Union. And we'll also talk about the Democratic primaries. It's all coming up on The Morning Show.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Eric Wustewald. Ahead of President Obama's seventh and final State of the Union address, Media Matters has looked back at conservative media's long history of attacking the annual address. Just listen to this rap sheet of vitriol from Fox News and right-wing radio hosts towards the president and his speech over the last 6 years.
Who wants to sit there and listen to somebody lie for an hour and 15 minutes?
Last night, our president declared war on success.
So I expect a very divisive, very evil speech tonight.
A Castro-like speech last night, albeit in English.
That big propaganda speech.
Does it matter what the president says tonight?
And that has been my State of the Union response every year. I hope he fails.
President Obama is reported to discuss topics such as terrorism, the economy, and gun control, and also reflect on how far we've come in his final address to Congress and the American people. Conservative media will almost assuredly look to twist the president's words one final time, but Media Matters will be there to hold their lies accountable to the truth. For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
All right, and I do appreciate Media Matters holding the right-wing media to a standard of honesty that they never hold themselves to. That said, it's hard to take them as seriously as I used to because they're so clearly in the tank for Hillary and refuse to call out media misinformation, media lies, bias against Senator Sanders. Dow is up 53 points, the same exact pattern. Wasn't it up yesterday and wasn't it up Monday early? The past couple days it fell later in the day. Let's hope that doesn't recur again. Dow is down 57 points to 16,573. NASDAQ up 22 to 4708. S&P 500 up just 8 points to 1947. Gold flat, no change at 1,085. It's down a few pennies. The price of a barrel of oil is up 89 cents, currently priced at $31.35. All right, you know, before I told you, well, let's see, we do another Bowie duet. I could play more of Jagger and Bowie, but you know what? Let's do this. Queen and Bowie. That's a live version from a concert in London, and they sound great. And there's another band. I respect Queen. I don't hate Queen. They don't grab me. My son loves Queen. He's a huge fan. They're all right. Bohemian Rhapsody and all that. We Are the Champions. I'm not dissing your Queen fan. I have nothing bad to say about that band. I think Freddie Mercury's great. Like Jagger, bouncing around, dancing on stage, having fun. How cool is that? It's really cool. I'm not into them to the same degree. That's all. There's nothing negative about that band. By the way, I'm not saying anything bad. By the way, Bowie looking great up there with Mercury and sounding great. So, you know what, Kirk, Jack, I'm sorry, what you were saying about the duets, I'm feeling it. I'm feeling that. Yeah, he does. He sounds good with other acts, and we'll get you some more duets. All right, where am I on the Obama speeches? I have to say, I kind of get where Hillary was back in 2008 when I hear all of these, and I think of all the Obama States of the Union.
So let's have a real campaign. Enough with the speeches and the big rallies and then using tactics that are right out of Carl Rove.
He doesn't use tactics out of a barrel. But yeah, all right, enough with the speeches. Let's see some action. That's what I want. Action, action. We want action. All right, let's get to the State of the Union. I've been hemming and hawing. I've been just delaying and distracting. I've been doing everything possible, playing it. I got a lot of different spots marked. Let's see if I can get this here. I've got this video. This is courtesy of YouTube. I went all over the internet trying to find the best, the cleanest version. I guess this is as good as any. And I'm going to try to play it, those sections. Obviously, it's an hour-long speech, and you know me. I can't just let the president speak. I got to interrupt. I got to interject. So that makes it harder, you know, for me to play the whole thing. I couldn't do it. We would be here for 2 days. I want to say this. The president is such a good speech maker. He is so articulate, and he doesn't use any superfluous words. This is what's really tough. You just have to pick and choose what you want to play. But you got to know when you play the president's speeches, you're missing whatever you don't play. Whatever you don't play is going to be just as important and just as good and just as articulate and persuasive as what you don't play. You just have to pick and choose. That's who he is, because he's just great at giving speeches. I think, you know. I mean, again, it's personal taste, right? You know, I like Queen and Bowie. I don't love them. I love The Who. What can I tell you? That's who I am. So the same thing with Obama. I love his speeches. Every last word he uses, I think, is tremendous. I just wish he'd follow through sometimes on the soaring rhetoric. Let's go to they don't give him the Rose Garden. He's in Congress. This was delivered to Congress last night. And I want to just see, what was this part of it? This was on, now that's the wrong event. Let me just get this right. This is on, okay, yeah, let's go to global warming. Here we are, the President Obama last night.
Look. If anybody still wants to dispute the science around climate change, have at it. You will be pretty lonely, because you'll be debating our military, most of America's business leaders, the majority of the American people, almost the entire scientific community, and 200 nations around the world who agree it's a problem and intend to solve it. But even if the planet wasn't at stake, even if 2014 wasn't the warmest year on record, until 2015 turned out to be even hotter, why would we want to pass up the chance for American businesses to produce and sell the energy of the future?
He hit all the high notes there. I mean, look, again, what am I supposed to say? Yeah, me too. Uh-huh. Right on, Obama. No question about Obamanos. I mean, he just got it. He nailed it. All the right points. It's true. You try to argue, you're going to be lonely because there's really no debate at all. There's certainly no intellectual debate. And the fact that even if you don't believe it, guess what? We're better off acting like it's true. Acting like it's really happening in terms of job creation, in terms of being good citizens around the world, in terms of conserving energy, which is a good thing whether there's global warming or not. I mean, I don't see how there's anything even to add. The president nailed that. He gets an A on that. And here's why, by the way, you have to vote for the Democrat, whether it's Clinton or, as I hope it is, Sanders. Or O'Malley, perhaps. I got to throw that in. I don't really think it's going to be O'Malley, but I got to throw it in. They're not crazy. They're not pathological. They're not delusional. They're not, schizophrenics. Now, there's psychotic is not somebody who's, if you're psychotic, you can be grounded in reality. You might not be if you're a psychotic schizophrenic, but psychosis doesn't mean you're not grounded in reality. It just means that you don't really, you're sick, you're diseased, you don't have human feelings. You're a psychopath. That's Ted Cruz. Ted Cruz knows that global warming is real. I mean, the guy went to Princeton, went to Harvard, got good grades. He knows it's true. But he lies to you about it. That makes him a psychopath. But the Republican Party operates under the delusion that what's true isn't, that what's real isn't, that all the extreme weather and the ever hotter temperatures, that's not really happening. So they are not, as a collective, necessarily psychopaths, not as a collective, necessarily sociopaths, they're schizophrenic. They see things that aren't there. They hear things that aren't there, and they don't see things that are. The president, Senator Sanders, Secretary of State Clinton, Governor O'Malley, they see what's there, and they don't see what isn't. If you have a choice between someone who's mentally ill, who clearly falls within the definition of suffering from a personality disorder or worse, I think you vote for the person who doesn't have the personality disorder, and that would be whoever the Democrat is in the race for the presidency, the race for the White House. All right, phone number 844-4-HELL-G if you want to join me. I'd love to talk to you about any of these topics. 844-367-4254. By the way, I haven't been getting a lot of calls lately, but I have been getting a lot of really nice feedback, people enjoying what I'm doing. Saying you're doing a good job. You know, I liked it. Great show. 844-4-HELL-G. 844-367-4254. Break coming up. I do want to respond to a comment by Jeff, which is interesting. 844-4-HELL-G, 844-367. They're always interesting. They're always thought-provoking. That's all on the morning show coming up.
Hi, everybody. 7 years ago, the American auto industry was on the brink of collapse. Plants were closing. Hundreds of thousands of workers were getting laid off from jobs that had been their ticket to a middle-class life. And as the pain spread across the country, another 1 million Americans would have lost their jobs in the middle of the worst economic crisis of our lifetimes. Some said it was too late to turn things around, but I refused to turn my back on so many of the workers that I had met. Instead, I placed my bet on American workers. I placed my bet on American manufacturing. In exchange for help, we demanded responsibility. We said the auto industry would have to truly change, not just pretend that it did. We got labor and management to settle their differences. We got the industry to retool and restructure. Everyone had some skin in the game. Our plan wasn't popular. Critics said it was a road to socialism or a disaster waiting to happen. But I'd make that bet again any day of the week, because today the American auto industry is back. Since our plan went into effect, our automakers have added more than 640,000 new jobs. We've cut the Detroit area unemployment rate by more than half. The big three automakers are raising wages. 7 years ago, auto sales hit a 27-year low. Last year, they hit an all-time high. Later this month, I'll visit the Detroit Auto Show to see this progress firsthand, because I believe that every American should be proud of what our most iconic industry has done. It's not unlike what America overall has done these past 7 years. Our businesses are now on a 70-month streak of job creation, with more than 14 million new jobs in all. We've revamped our schools and the way we pay for college. We've made historic investments in clean energy and put ourselves on a path to a low-carbon future. We've brought more than 17 million Americans into our healthcare system, seen healthcare prices grow at the lowest rate in 50 years, and covered more than 90% of our people for the very first time. We've even cut our deficits by nearly 75% in the process. The point is, America can do anything. Even in times of great challenge and change, our future is entirely up to us. That's been on my mind while I'm writing my final State of the Union address. And on Tuesday, I'm going to talk about the choices we have to make to set this country firmly on an even better, brighter course for decades to come. Thanks, and have a great weekend.
All right, President Obama. I guess it's all Obama all the time broadcasts, because we just heard the weekend address, you know, the radio address, the weekly address, and I will get right back to the State of the Union. By the way, apparently some dead air. Oh, I don't hear that. That's got me a little concerned. Yeah, I heard that there was a problem with the broadcast, and I'm not getting it. So that's not good. And I should be hearing it. I'm looking, everything's going out like it should be. Let me just make sure what happened there? Let's see, was there, nice, look at that. Okay, well, we got a problem. Okay, here the thing is, that's not good. I'm going to keep talking because this is all being broadcast. This is all being recorded, and we're going to post everything. So if you miss something, then, you know, you can listen. Well, you will miss it. But I'm going to see if I can get you back on. I think there was a streaming issue here. That's not good. Huh. Look at that. Let's see if we can figure out what's causing this problem. Okay, so we'll be streaming again in a second. This is the first time this has happened in a long time. Not happy about this. Okay. So, all right, we should be back on now. Not able to connect. That is not good. So, thank you for... I see. That was the problem. So, we may have to change the setup here a little bit. All right, now I am back on. We had some dead time there. I am very, very sorry, folks. Phone number 844-4-HELL-G, 844-367-4254. Here's the good thing. If you missed any of the last, I don't know how long I was off, I will be posting this, and you'll hear the whole show. So that is really unfortunate. I'm very sorry that we lost the audio there for quite a while, too. Hey, if that happens again, yeah, probably bet you some of you were texting me. Well, what can I tell you? I didn't get them because I wasn't sitting at my computer. I am playing Bowie duets, thanks to Jack. And if you have requests, it shows I will play requests for you as well. 844-4-HELGY, 844-367-4254. Yeah, that is not good about losing the audio stream. Not happy about that. Not happy at all. We'll have to figure out a way to prevent that from recurring. I think I have a solution. I don't know how good it'll be. 844-4-HELGY, 844-367-4254. The president's weekly address, the comments on climate change are spot on. That's why you got to vote for him. Honestly, that is why he's clearly better than any alternative. And when I say alternative Republican, that's why all the Democrats are better. Clinton, Sanders, O'Malley, all superior to any of the Republicans because they're not psychopaths. They're not lying to you without regard to the consequences of the planet. And moreover, they're not delusional either. I mean, they don't believe things that aren't true. 844-4-HELGY from Jeff. Jeff did not appreciate my comments about the president taking kids out of classrooms. He didn't like them. Here's what he, which is odd. You never think he would defend the president, but here's what he had to say. So he wrote, no, that's not, he's claiming that it's so strange. His point was, I'm criticizing the president for, so you're questioning why the chief law enforcement officer in our country is enforcing the law. What a strange land you live in. Yeah, I am questioning it. I think it's a mistake. I think he's wrong. I think it's a bad law. I think that it's heartless. I think it's cruel. He has discretion. He doesn't have to send the shock troops in, the stormtroopers in. He doesn't have to do that. We're talking about people who are not a danger to anybody, who aren't hurting anybody, who themselves have fled violence. Yeah, I think it's wrong that he's doing that. To me, it's strange that you don't see it that way, to be honest with you, Jeff. 844-4-HELGY, 844-367-4254. We're going to... wow, how did that happen? Folks, I'm just distraught. I'm distressed. I don't like it when there's any technical glitches. So I'll tell you what we're going to do to make up for that. Quick break, and we'll talk to Michael Petrilli. That won't be until a little after 10. But now, you know what? Forget about the break. That's not fair to you. I just can't do that. So I'll tell you what we'll do instead. We'll go back to the President's State of the Union. I already played some of it. You got to hear it. You got to just go back and listen to the whole show on the internet, which you'll have the opportunity to do. Let me get back to the President. And here he is. Let's see. I think he's talking about the military here. I believe that is where he's going to go at this point in the speech. We just heard him talk about how there's just no question about global warming, and if you don't believe in it, you got a tough argument to make because pretty much everyone gets it. But also, even if you don't believe in it, we're still better off acting as though it's real. President on the military.
It's not even close. We spend more on our military than the next 8 nations combined. Our troops are the finest fighting force in the history of the world.
Well, I wasn't happy about this segment, but I wanted to play it for you. He's bragging about how we spend all that money. Why is that good? Why is that a good thing? He's saying we're still a great nation because we spend so much on the military. But my answer to that, my question, my response to that is President Obama. Great nations don't need to spend inordinate sums of money on the military. And there are plenty of examples of countries that spend a much higher, even a higher percentage of their GDP on the military than we do. And they're hardly great nations. North Korea, anybody? We should be leading through the power of our ideas, through our economy, which works for all, not through brute force. Not through violence. So this to me was a weak area of the speech. Taking pride in where we're harming people. Where we're acting in a way that's destructive. I was not thrilled with this part of the speech. Let me move on. President is going to take a quick victory lap. which is kind of odd since we haven't won any races, when he talks about Syria. And yet, I think he's right. And yet, despite the criticism he got from New York Times columnist Nick Kristof, who bashed him for claiming the Syria policy is working when it's not, I think the president is absolutely right here.
Both Al-Qaeda and now ISIL pose a direct threat to our people because in today's world, even a handful of terrorists who place no value on human life, including their own, can do a lot of damage. They use the internet to poison the minds of individuals inside our country. Their actions undermine and destabilize our allies. We have to take them out. But as we focus on destroying ISIL, over-the-top claims that this is World War III just play into their hands. Masses of fighters on the back of pickup trucks, twisted souls plotting in apartments or garages, they pose an enormous danger to civilians. They have to be stopped. But they do not threaten our national existence. That is the story ISIL wants to tell. That's the kind of propaganda they use to recruit. We don't need to build them up to show that we're serious. And we sure don't need to push away vital allies in this fight by echoing the lie that ISIL is somehow representative of one of the world's largest religions.
All right, now's as good a time, I guess, as any to go to that top of the hour break. President nailing it there, of course. And very well played, where he talks about, yeah, they're a threat. They're not as big a threat as anyone's made them out to be. Certainly not an existential one. And then hammering the point home, the last thing we should be doing is demonizing religion, claiming that they somehow represent all Muslims. So that is a really strong aspect. And again, the president is just, he's really good. He speaks really well. He is extremely intelligent. We haven't seen that in the White House. I mean, I know Clinton, I guess Clinton was, I never felt that intelligence emanating from Clinton. And obviously, it didn't from W. And it certainly didn't from the great communicator. All right, phone number 844-4HELG if you want to join me, 844-367-4254. We're going to hit that top of the hour break. Now we'll come back, we'll talk to Michael Petrilli. We'll talk about Friedrichs, we'll talk about public employee unions, specifically teachers, and whether we should be protecting our public school teachers. We should allow them to protect themselves through unions, and specifically with unions that have the authority, the power, to withhold fees to pay for collective bargaining, even if some members of the union say, we don't want to pay for that. We don't want to be responsible for that. We don't want to have to reach into our pockets to pay for those who bargain to get us a better wage and better working conditions. All come up on the morning show.
It's Tuesday, January 12, 2016.
This was the literal thing we had to do, to put ourselves in front of a train to say, we will not take this anymore.
Oil train protesters use necessity defense in oil train blockade.
These new rates have made it impossible for us to operate as a business here.
Huge setback for solar in Nevada. Extreme weather is extremely expensive. 2015 broke the record for the most expensive wildfires. Plus, another one bites the dust. Another big coal company goes bankrupt.
All of those stories and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
For those of you who don't habla español, El Niño is Spanish for the Niño.
This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, you always bring amazing stories, but today there's one in particular out of Nevada. Don't know if that's your first one, but it kind of blows my mind.
Yep, in Nevada, the solar industry is leaving Las Vegas and the entire state.
We were heartbroken that they made this choice to just rip the rug out from under thousands of customers, thousands of employees. These new rates have made it impossible for us to operate as a business here.
That was a regional manager of industry leader Solar City after the Nevada Public Utilities Commission approved a recent request by Nevada's monopoly electric utility, NV Energy, to gut the state's solar net metering program that pays rooftop solar owners.
We're going to talk about Friedrichs. We're going to talk about the impact of the decision to say to teachers' unions you can no longer withhold funds, fees, in order to fund collective bargaining. If that, then that's what's being requested. That's what's being asked for in Friedrichs. So let's see if we can get our guest, Petrilli, on right now. So you'll just have to bear with me for just a moment because we're dealing with this technical problem here that we've been fighting. And let's see if we can get him. And I'm also going to try to get you a appropriate song as well, but we may be just going right on the air with Petrilli.
Drawing a contrast in this campaign.
Yes, this is Mr. Petrilli. Hi, this is Hal Ginsberg. We've got Michael Petrilli with us, and we're right
Hi,
on the
this
is Hal Ginsberg. Yes, Michael Petrilli. Hello. Wow, that's freaky. It was like a mirror where you keep seeing the same image over and over and over again. So let's see if we can try one more time to get Michael Petrilli. And we'll see if this is him. It's pretty amateurish. Here we go. Mr. Petrilli?
Hey, yes.
Mr. Petrilli, Hal Ginsberg here. I'm very sorry. We're fighting some pretty bad technical problems here. We're trying to remote from, which we normally have no difficulty doing here in Maryland, where I am, Kensington, to the West Coast, Monterey. But we got it. I think it's all squared away. As best I can tell, everything's working well. I couldn't get a teacher song playing, but what the heck. I found you, you had written a pretty critical article about, I guess, not teachers' unions, I don't want to mischaracterize, but about the idea that the teachers' unions can deduct fees from teachers who would prefer to opt out, fees to help pay for collective bargaining. So if I misrepresent your position at any time, please correct me. I'll get the exact article for everyone. But just tell us, am I right? Is that your concern? And why is that a concern as far as you are concerned?
Well, that's right. This was an issue in a Supreme Court case that was heard on Monday. This is the Friedrichs case. The question is whether people who decide not to be members of a teachers union or other public employee unions still have to pay these, what they call agency fees, or the unions call, fair share fees. The unions say, hey, you know, we will allow you not to be in the union, and you don't have to pay for the union's political activities, doing things like endorsing candidates or running ads. However, if you don't help pay for the collective bargaining itself or the other regular day-to-day activities of the union, then you're a freeloader. You're going to get the benefit of collective bargaining in terms of higher salaries or benefits, and it's not fair for you not to pay for it. The other argument on the other side is that, well, this is really a First Amendment problem. The courts have held for a long time that people cannot be compelled to pay for political speech with which they disagree. And what the teachers in this case say is, hey, when you're collective bargaining with a school board, that's an elected school board that is inherently political, and you are pushing for things that I may not agree with, such as last in, first out policies if there have to be layoffs, basically higher salaries that are going to require the government to raise taxes to pay for those salaries. And so that's the issue at case. And it looks pretty clearly from what happened on Monday that the conservative justices of the Supreme Court agree with these teachers who want to opt out of all of this.
And Mike Petrilli is with us. He's a research fellow at Stanford's Hoover Institution. Do you know David Henderson? Professor Henderson has been with me on my show on a number of occasions. He's also at Hoover. I know it's a big sprawling institution, and he's in
Monterey. Yeah, and I'm a non-resident fellow, so I'm here in Washington, D.C., so I don't.
You have no familiarity with him. Very libertarian in his views, I would assume, similar to you as well.
Yeah.
Petrilli wrote with Mike Antonucci, the two Mikes there, wrote why the Friedrichs court case will give teachers more power and better pay at the74million.org, and we are glad to have him with us on the show. He is also president of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. Now, I get the concern that you just raised. I think there, you know, this is one of those situations where you have competing interests. You have the interest of all the teachers to bargain collectively and not to have free riders. You call them freeloaders. I think the general term of art is the free rider problem.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that you have that interest on the one side, the interest of the whole, and then there's the interest of the individual. Hey, I'm a new teacher. And frankly, if there are layoffs, I'd rather the school board lay off the older teachers who are getting more money so I can keep my job. Certainly there are competing interests in that case. So why do you come down on the side of those who say we shouldn't be paying for the costs of bargaining collectively with the school board?
Well, first and foremost, for me, it is the First Amendment issue that – we have this tradition in this country, and I think it's right to say that we're not going to make people pay for political activities with which they disagree. And in the public sector, when collective bargaining is inherently political, I just don't think you can get around that problem. That compelling people to be a part of the union or pay for its activities if they're not a member is definitely violating that principle. But there's more than that. In terms of how the education system works, the teacher unions work, I do think that it is a healthier system to have, if we're going to have teacher unions, to have them be organizations that have to recruit members by providing services and benefits that those members agree with. And right now, and what we've had really for decades now, is a system where the more experienced teachers, the ones who tend to be very powerful in the unions, and even retired teachers, they end up warping the system to meet their needs, and it doesn't meet the needs of younger teachers or highly effective teachers in many cases. So, this practice that we've had of saying that if there are layoffs, as there were a few years ago when the economy went south, that we're just going to lay off the newest teachers. Well, I mean, not only is that bad for those new teachers, it's terrible for students who are stuck with low-performing teachers that happen to have tenure, that might be 20-year veterans, might be totally burned out. And yet those teachers stay, and some of these new, energetic, very effective young teachers get laid off only because of experience. That doesn't make any sense at all. So when we look at states that do not have teacher unions or that do not require these fair share fees, you tend to have policies that are a little more commonsensical, a little more friendly to reform, that are not quite so skewed against the younger teachers or the effective teachers. You look at a system where there's almost no unions, which is the charter school system, public charter schools, and in fact, you see much greater flexibility. You see much, much greater attention to making teaching a very very appealing profession for young people, make it possible for young people, if they are effective, to get paid a decent salary, to have good working conditions. So it's not all skewed in the same way that our education system is today. And so I think on the merits as well, that this decision, if it goes the way we expect, and if the teacher unions do end up losing some of their power, that in the end will be good for the cause of education reform.
Your argument would certainly analogize across to private sector employees, right? I mean, if you think that the public employee union is taking positions that are antithetical to some of its members, which thereby violates those members' constitutional right to free speech, then that exact same argument would apply with full force when it comes to private sector unions as well, would it not?
Well, not really. I mean, not the free speech argument, okay? Because in the private sector, if you are collective bargaining with General Motors, right, that is not a political body. And so the collective bargaining itself doesn't raise those same free speech rights.
Yeah, but in either case, the collective bargaining representative is speaking for all the members of the private sector union or all the members of the public sector union.
Right.
And that doesn't change depending on who the employer is.
Well, no, but what I'm raising here, and I think I see your point for sure, that there are still concerns in the private sector that, you know, do you give people the chance to opt out or do you give employees a choice? But in terms of free speech rights, it really is just in the public sector that we have this particular problem that you are bargaining with the government. You know, this is why even way back when Franklin Delano Roosevelt believed that there should not be public sector unions, because then inherently they were organized against the public. They were bargaining with the public, and that didn't make sense. In the private sector, you could, you know, make the argument that you need to maybe balance the interests of these big corporations with the interests of workers. Whether you agree with that or not, it doesn't raise the same free speech issues.
I honestly don't see. I don't find that a convincing claim on your part. I think that it's, in fact, I also would say that those who are against the public sector unions are equally opposed to private sector unions. And this is one of those camel's noses under the tent that we've heard so much about. Let me ask it this way, Mr. Petrilli. How would you protect workers? How would you protect employees without unions? I'm sense that you are opposed to unions, and I've criticized them on occasion. There's no question they take positions that sometimes are against the public interest. But they're workers. They're human beings. They provide a vital service. They deserve a middle-class life. They deserve to be able to take care of their families. They deserve good health care. Now, if you said, hey, I support universal single-payer coverage, so whether you're a member of a union or not, you're still going to get it, that would go a long way towards my being more persuaded by your view. But generally, employers hold the cards. They hold the whip hand. Without unions, how would you protect them?
Well, first of all, I haven't taken a position that I'm against all unions, and in fact, I'm not against private sector unions. I think that there's a role to play there.
Are you against mandatory dues for union members who are part of a collective bargaining unit, who take the fee so they can pay for the collective bargaining?
You know, I am an education policy guy, so I have to admit that I haven't given that a whole lot of thought.
How would you protect teachers if teachers can't
done
the teachers, they can't done every member of the collective bargaining unit, how are you going to protect them? American teachers make less than their counterparts in Western Europe. And in those states where, at this moment, teachers' unions are strong, Massachusetts, New Jersey, Maryland, New York, we see relatively high-performing schools, and we also see better conditions for teachers. So if you get rid of that ability for the unions to fund the bargaining, how do you protect teachers?
So let's peel that back some. Okay, first of all, there are now a majority of states that do not require these fair share fees. Okay, so they are right-to-work states, so we can see how that's working. And in those states, you have plenty of those states that paid teachers quite well and that have very good teaching conditions. I think about a state that I'm near here in the D.C. area, Virginia, doesn't have a teacher shortage problem, has high teacher morale, good reputation for schools. They have no unions, right? Now, many of the states that you mentioned, it's true, they do have high-performing schools and they have unions. They're also wealthy states, right? And they spend a lot of money on education. That's part of it. We see many states around the country, like Florida, for example, where you don't have unions or you don't have this required dues-paying mandate, but you've seen huge progress in terms of student achievement over the years. And look, the reason is any good administrator knows that if they're going to get good performance, that's because they're going to be able to recruit great teachers and keep them. Part of that is paying them fairly and providing good benefits. Part of that is providing excellent working conditions. And by the way, the sector where we see teachers flocking to are these high-performing charter schools in many of our cities, which have, are very challenging. I mean, they are working their teachers hard, and they are aiming for incredibly high goals. But because the teachers have a chance to really have an impact, have a great environment with other colleagues that they respect and get results, teachers are lining up at the door to teach in those. So you know, I think that the evidence is that even in the absence of the teacher unions, teachers in most places are still treated well. They do make more than most teachers do overseas. That's just an inaccurate statement you made about Europe. You know, could they be better paid in some places? Absolutely. But that's usually more an issue about whether there's money available, local property taxes and the like. The unions, more than, you know, they've been relatively unsuccessful in driving up pay. What the unions have been successful in doing in many places is increasing red tape, creating all kinds of rules and requirements about what has to happen in the schools, what teachers may or may not be required to do. And that has made it very difficult, especially in our big cities, for unionized schools to get good results for our neediest kids.
All right, we have Mike Petrilli with us. He co-wrote an article that grabbed my attention in Opinion, the 74, Why the Friedrichs Case Will Give Teachers More Power and Better Pay by Mike Petrilli. Very interesting. He's with the Hoover Institute. We got a few more minutes left. I appreciate your time. I appreciate your pushing back as well. Obviously, we don't see this the same way, but I think you make some very legitimate points. My concern is with the employees to a very significant degree. I don't disagree with you that there are some negative effects that unions do have. And the issue of last in, first out is mixed. You seem to present only the downside, but there's also a good side. Experienced teachers who are doing a really good job. We know there's a real value in being an experienced in any field. I think that, you know, it's kind of a cliche now, but you know, Sully Sullenberger, the more senior pilot who landed his plane under very trying conditions in the Hudson River, was older, and his vision wasn't as good as a young buck just out of the Air Force. But because of his experience landing in all kinds of weather and conditions, he was able to save the life of his passengers. So there's always value in seniority, although you also raise a fair point. There are burnt-out teachers as well. So I think what you might want to give principals the flexibility to let those teachers who have been working many years and may not be performing at the highest level, let them know they have got to improve their game or they will be let go. But don't we already have that situation? Isn't that the way it is now? An effective administrator lets teachers know that if they don't work harder and they don't do a better job, if it's substandard, they will in fact be let go. Mm-hmm. Principals can discharge poor teachers, even in school districts with powerful unions. Is that not the case?
That is definitely not the case. I mean, that's, you know, the unions like to make that case. They say, oh, well, the administrators could do this. What they don't tell you is the fine print that what they have gotten into many of these union contracts, if not state statute, are these due process requirements that mean that it will take you years and thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars, to get one ineffective teacher out of the classroom because there are so many different you know, hearings, and then it goes up to this person, and it goes to that person, and you have to show, you know, you have to put together this incredible dossier to demonstrate that the teacher is ineffective. That's why you hear these terrible stories about teachers who are, you know, showing up drunk, who are abusing children, who are, you know, really out, you know, just doing horrible things, and even there it's difficult to fire them, you know, much less a teacher who just maybe at one time was a decent teacher and is now burned out and just not putting her heart and soul into it anymore. Getting rid of a teacher like that can be extremely difficult. And so these are serious problems that we're facing. Now, look, a lot of the reform efforts in recent years have been trying to address that, and we've made some progress. There are some states that have gotten rid of their last-in, first-out policies that have tried to make some reforms so that ineffective teachers can be moved out of the classroom. But in those strong union states that she mentioned, those protections, by and large, are still there. And we still have a whole lot of teachers who, you know, just aren't well equipped to be in the classroom and intend to be in classroom serving our poorest kids. And so, you know, earlier you said, look, my concern is with the workers. I am concerned about the workers too. I want teachers to have good conditions. I want to be able to recruit great people in the classroom. But I also am concerned about the students. And we've had a system where their needs have not been a priority for a long, long time. And that's what we're trying to work on changing. And frankly, the unions have not been on board with a lot of those reforms.
Well, I think that's a very controversial statement. I mean, unions are consistently going to school boards and politicians and saying, we need more money for books. We need more money for planning time, which they do need. If you want a teacher to be a good teacher, they need continuing education. So while you raise a legitimate point about, and I think there has to be a balance. Would you, when it comes to discharging ineffective teachers, would you make teaching an at-will profession?
Yes.
So you would say that at any moment a principal can simply fire whomever she or he wants.
I would be comfortable with that. And that's how it works in private schools. That's how it works in most charter schools. That's how it works in most of the American economy.
Private schools.
Now, of course,
private,
there are.
Well, let me just interrupt for a sec, because private schools have to compete with each other to get money from the parents who send their kids there. So a private school that gets rid of its best teachers is going to lose, its customers, its base. That doesn't happen with public schools. Moreover, you have a situation where, well, why would, because public schools are for all children and there's no charge to attend. And if you have a situation where you have balanced budgeting demagogues who insist that they're going to cut every penny out, every ounce of fat out of the public schools, they're elected into office, including into the school board, then all the senior teachers would be fired. You'd have salaries cut, and you'd have ineffective, unqualified teachers with no experience who would be teaching every class if we followed your model.
All right, well, hold on. Let's go way down that road here. Let's back up a couple steps here. Okay, first of all, we should continue to have various protections that we have for all workers. So, for example, you can't fire people on the basis of their age. Okay, you can't you can't discriminate against people on various other attributes. That still stays in place, right? You say that we're going to fire the experienced teachers because they make so much more money. Well, let's ask this. Why do they make so much more money? Certainly, a five-year veteran should make more than a rookie teacher, because we know that after 5 years, you've learned a lot on the job. But why is it that, say, a 50-year-old teacher is making a lot more money than a 30-year-old teacher? What we know is that, in general, those teachers are doing the same job, and they are, on average, equally effective. And yet we have a structure in public education where, you know, you basically get paid more just for doing the same job one more year, one more year, one more year.
My wife's been a teacher for, I don't know, 18 years now, and she has gotten better and better. There's no question about it. But I would say that there's another reason. There's another reason for that. Because we make a deal with teachers. We say, you know what? You've got a college degree. Many of you have a master's degree. Some of you have a PhD. Mm-hmm. You could go into other fields. You could make more money. You could have a future where you have the potential to make six-figure salaries, high six-figure salaries, and you are going to forego that because you're going to do something that is in the public interest, that serves all of us. Mm-hmm. And one way we're going to reward you for making that decision that is in our interest is to make sure that you will get regular salary increases. You will remain comfortably in the middle class. You will certainly not be upper middle class. You won't make the kind of money that people who write articles that serve the best interests of the 1% make, but you will still make a decent living and you will retire comfortably. I think that's kind of the bargain that we have made with teachers and with other public employee, employees.
It is, and how is it working? I mean,
I think it's worked out well. I think it's incredible the kind of value we get for teachers and overcrowded classrooms, teachers who aren't getting the support that we should give them, and correctly, as you point out as well, teachers who are not doing a very good job. There are some bad apples in there, and I agree with you. We need to figure out better ways to take them out of the barrel.
Well, and look, I think we've got a lot of great teachers, and we've got more great teachers than we deserve based on how we often treat them. So we can agree on that. But look, on any measure, our schools are underperforming schools around the world. They are overspending schools around the world. This model is not working, and it doesn't work for millennials who don't plan to spend 30 years in the same job. There are some systems that do it differently. Here in the District of Columbia, where I live, there were some big reforms to teacher pay. It is now possible that you can be a seven-year teacher, so let's say about 30 years old, and making six figures as a teacher. If you are high-performing, if you're willing to teach in some of the tougher schools. And that's what we need. We need to flatten the pay scale so that people can get to those higher salaries faster based on performance. And then I've got no problem paying teachers more. And then there's an incentive to keep those more expensive teachers because they're more valuable. You're getting more out of them. That's what it means to be a professional. You look at other professionals, you see similar salary schedules. It means, you know, paying people based on the value that they're adding. Teachers want to be professionals, and yet we pay them, you know, like they're factory line workers. It doesn't make sense anymore. It's not working, and we need to move to something different. And the unions, for a whole variety of reasons, for their own internal politics, and partly because of who's in power in those unions, have just not been able to go along with those reforms.
All right, well, I'll let you go with that. I really appreciate your time, Mr. Petrilia, and you took my questions very well and responded, I think, very well. So I appreciate your time. I learned something, especially with regard to salaries around the world. I want to look that up, but it appears you're correct. We do not underpay our teachers relative to other highly advanced nations, and that is something I was not aware of. So I thank you for bringing that to my attention. Yeah. Have a great day, sir.
All right. Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. That's bye-bye. Michael Petrilli from the Hoover Institute, and taking a different view on unions. And I think this is one of those eras, and I've, you know, raised my concerns about unions, but I don't see how we cannot allow them, how we can gut their ability to pay for collective bargaining. This is essential. This is what allows teachers to have a middle class life. And I find it very disheartening that people are willing to take their, you know, intelligence, take their education, and use it as a weapon, as a bludgeon against individual teachers, trying to push them into a working class, poor to working class lifestyle, which they're not that far from right now. All right, I'll tell you what, quick break. I want to get back to the president. I want to address a couple of points he made, especially about the teacher's salaries. That is real interesting to me. I did not know that teachers are making less than the rest here are making more. Teachers around the world are often making less than our teachers. I was not aware of that, especially when it comes to developing nations. I want to look into that a little further. The data seems to be somewhat unclear to me. All right, 844-4-HAL-G if you want to join me. 844-367-4254.
This is Scientific American's 60 Second Science. I'm Jason Goldman. Got a minute? Hippopotamuses. People usually think of them as massive lumbering hulks of plant-eating muscle. Reports do crop up of hippos snacking on crocs or chowing down on a drowned wildebeest, but those anecdotes are often dismissed as aberrant behaviors, opportunistic protein snacks added to a diet made mostly of salad. But it turns out that hungry, hungry hippos intentionally seek out the sweet, sweet taste of animal flesh.
We saw a bunch of wild dogs came and attacked a impala, and the impala jumped into the water, tried to swim across the little lake, and the hippo killed it. Then a few minutes later, that hippo and some bunch of other hippos started eating on that impala.
University of Alaska researcher Joseph P. Dudley was in Zimbabwe studying elephants when he saw this scene play out more than 20 years ago.
About that time, the wild dogs caught and killed another impala right next to the edge of the water hole, and three hippos came out of the water and tried to take away the carcass of the impala, the antelope, from the wild dogs. As far as I had ever heard, hippos didn't do either of those things.
We now know that carnivory is actually common among hippos, and meat eating could explain what's been a hippo public health mystery. Anthrax outbreaks happen naturally among African herbivores, but the pattern of anthrax transmission in hippos has always puzzled researchers. Could their hankering for meat explain it? Dudley's latest research suggests that the hippos could owe their unique susceptibility to anthrax die-offs to their practice of eating meat that carries the infection, including the bodies of other dead hippos. The study is in the journal Mammal Review. And that means that humans who come into contact with hippo meat need to take care. At least 511 Zambians became infected, and 5 died because they handled or consumed hippo meat during a 2011 anthrax outbreak among the amphibious mammals. That's one advantage of being a vegetarian for both hippos and humans. Thanks for the minute. For Scientific American's 60 Second Science, I'm Jason Goldman.
All right, let me look at the stock market. The Dow down 46 points now to 16,467. NASDAQ off 25 to 4660. S&P 500 down 6 to 1933. Gold's up $2 an ounce to 1,087. Oil is up 90 cents a barrel, currently priced at $31.33. And I wanted to address the comment by our last guest, Mike Petrilli, on how American teacher salaries are competitive with countries around the world. And I guess it's true. I looked at this list from Insider Monkey, Dateline July 30, 2015. And per Insider Monkey, American teachers are the 12th highest paid around the world at $47,165 average salary. I think that's a bit low. I think that's lower than what they should be getting, given their level of education, and given the incredibly important nature of the job. We are 12th in the world, so I guess that makes us pretty high up on the list. But there are a number of countries ahead of us, and some of them are direct competitors. Scotland, which is a poorer country, significantly poorer, pays their teachers more. South Korea pays more. Australia pays more. Belgium pays about $2,000 more per annum than we do to teachers. And it's important to realize that these other countries have universal single-payer coverage, so the teachers aren't responsible for their health care. They tend to have better retirement programs, so the teachers aren't going to have to pay for their retirement, although teachers do get good pensions generally in the United States. So we are better than many countries, but there are many that are ahead of us. Denmark, well ahead of us, about $4,000, $5,000, $6,000 more per year teachers make in Denmark. In the relatively poor country of Ireland, teachers make more. In Canada, teachers make well over $9,000 more per year than teachers in this country. The Netherlands, teachers make over $10,000 a year more than the United States. In Germany, teachers make $17,000 more a year than the United States. In Switzerland, $21,000 more a year than the United States. And in Luxembourg, apparently, teachers make close to $100,000 a year, so they're making more than double what teachers in the United States make. Now, I don't know how accurate Insider Monkey is. I don't know where they got this data. It doesn't strike me as the most plausible, necessarily. I mean, to say that Luxembourg teachers are making close to $100,000, where is France on this list? Is France paying that much less, for example, than Scotland and Ireland? What about the UK generally? Are Scotland and Ireland better to their teachers than England? So it's hard for me to totally buy this list. But the point is clear, notwithstanding what Petrilli said, and I'm pretty irritated by this, to be perfectly honest with you. He said, we're competitive. We pay as much as other countries. I guess you could say in a way, and I bought it for the moment. I was looking up the numbers. I was trying to figure them out at that moment. It did not comport with my understanding, but I did not have the chart in front of me. Somebody tells me something, I'm going to believe it. Okay, maybe there are countries that we compete with directly, like France, which doesn't pay its teachers as well as or and no better than we do. But the fact is, Canada, Germany, South Korea, Netherlands, they all pay their teachers much more than we pay our teachers. And I think that was an important fact that Petrilli elided, and I'm not happy about that. And that makes me feel less confident about the other opinions that he stated on this program. 844-4-HELL-G if you want to join me. 844-367-4254. 844-4-HELL-G. All right, should we get back to the State of the Union? We have got another hour and a half in the show, and we will certainly talk more about the President's State of the Union. 844-4-HELL-G, 844-367-4254. If you want to comment on Petrilli and what he had to say, I'm happy to hear from you as well. A lot of his commentary, and I didn't want to go after him and be obnoxious. He was saying we've all heard the horror stories about teachers who come in drunk. Okay. In every career, we've had pilots who fly drunk. I mean, that's really scary. You get on a plane, there's a drunk pilot, and they've instituted all manner of tests now, and it's much tougher. But you're always going to hear horror stories. To generalize that all teachers fit within the rubric or the parameters of the worst, to make that implication, I think is just wrong-headed. It's not fair. School districts without unions often are seeing themselves with teacher shortages, and yet at the same time paying teachers too little. The students are losing out. It's very hard for me to believe or to see the benefits that come in right-to-work type states where teachers cannot collectively bargain. It's also hard for me to see any real benefits to teachers when they, in fact, it would be just the opposite. They can be discharged at will. The concern about cost cutting is very, very real. Teachers are not overpaid today. So why would your concern be that we somehow need to keep their salaries low by firing the overpaid ones? If in general teachers aren't making more than they should be in any event. I also think he is ignoring that compact, that deal we make with teachers, which is, hey, you go into this career, you're going to be able to live a middle-class life. And to say, you know, we're not going to give you raises because you're not worth anything more to us than a $50,000 a year teacher, I think is just wrong-headed. Part of the motivation that teachers have to continue to perform at a good level, at a high level, so they continue into their 30s, into their 40s, into their 50s, to retirement age. Yes, it's not easy to discharge underperforming teachers, and I am willing to certainly accept that we have to look very closely at making it easier for administrators to discharge underperforming teachers. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't expect, and we don't, and or that we are not getting the best that most of these dedicated public servants have to offer. So I think ultimately Petrilli's arguments fall on deaf ears. One final point. I don't accept that First Amendment argument. It makes no sense. What the hell is the... You have somebody who represents you, who's bargaining for you. That's always collective bargaining. There's always going to be a tension between the various individuals who are being represented in the collective bargaining unit. How is their First Amendment right in any way being implicated, being impacted? I didn't hear any argument. It is not... Your First Amendment rights aren't being violated when your lawyer argues in favor of compensation or a compensation schedule that isn't in your best interests specifically. That's not violating your First Amendment rights. I get the argument that my First Amendment rights are violated when my union endorses a candidate I don't like. Yes, that's a fair point. And in fact, that problem is certainly accounted for in that unions do not collect 100% of the dues from those teachers who opt out. Seems like a pretty good system. Seems like a pretty workable system. If you don't agree, give me a call, 844-4-HELL-G, 844-367-4254. All right, let's see. What's... might as well hit. All right, let's hit that break. I do have more to say about, or more to play from, the President's State of the Union, but I'd like to hear your thoughts as well on teachers and what's fair and what isn't. What's an appropriate salary? What's an appropriate wage level? Should they be protected by representatives who bargain for all teachers? Should teachers have to pay at least the cost, if they're in a union, at least the cost of such a the expenses of having collective bargaining? All right, 844-4-HELG. Love to talk to you. 844-367-4254. I know Jack wants to hear those Bowie duets, so let's see if we can get some more. If we can get one or two more for him in today's show. It is, by the way, 1045 East Coast, 745 Pacific time. Here's kind of an oldie, but let's hope it's a goodie with Cher. 1975. What is this? The Cher show. But this is the Cher show. Now, I didn't remember the Cher show. I remember the Sonny and Cher show. I guess this was just after she split with Sonny. Close to the other time was yours. I was your man. Don't talk of heartaches. Ooh, I remember it all. Well, I'm checking you out one day. She sees if I'm faking it at all. Can you hear?
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
They're working you 12 hours a day at $12 an hour. You don't have time to spend with your family.
Selma, Alabama, Lear worker and union activist Latasha Irby. Irby and co-workers started efforts to organize a UAW local at the multinational Lear Corp's Selma Auto Parts plant in May of 2014. The company immediately started violating labor law with what the National Labor Relations Board says were illegal threats and intimidation tactics in captive audience meetings that workers were forced to attend.
Showing slideshows telling us that if we ever get the union in our plant, that our plant would close down, and that our customer, Hyundai and Montgomery, wouldn't want to accept our parts, and if we ever went to apply for another job and they saw that we come from a unionized plant, that they wouldn't want to hire us.
Latasha says that she's unintimidated, and here's what she will keep fighting to achieve.
I want to see the workers get a livable wage and a safer work environment. I just want them to be able to have a voice in their workplace, a voice about issues that concern the worker themselves, as opposed to the company always changing things to fit their agenda. They said we're a family, and we work together, we're a team, so why not come together as a team and value our opinion just as much as you want us to value your opinion.
The Nevada State AFL-CIO hosted a Raising Wages Summit on Tuesday. Workers, activists, and labor leaders came together in Las Vegas to discuss how they can work together to improve the lives of all Nevada working families. Danny Thompson, Executive Secretary-Treasurer of the Nevada AFL-CIO, says wages have been stagnant for a long time and working people need to come together and demand higher wages. And that message needs to go out to both Republican and Democratic candidates.
Wages in America are stagnant. As our productivity as workers has gone up, wages have gone the other way. We wanted to shine a light on that, get people fired up and involved. It's not just about billionaires who can buy elections. It's about low-wage workers who need help and who are working every day and can't afford to live.
Workers Independent News is heard daily on The Rick Smith Show, live 3 to 6 p.m. coast to coast at thericksmithshow.com. The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
WIN is made possible in part by the United Steelworkers.
Workers Independent News is brought to you by the 50,000 members of the Association of Flight Attendants, CWA, representing aviation's first responders and last line of defense, charged with the safety, health, and security of the passengers in their care. Information on how the AFA-CWA improves safety, pay, benefits, and working conditions for its members is online at afacwa.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
They use the internet to poison the minds of individuals inside our country. Their actions undermine and destabilize our allies. We have to take them out. But as we
talk, this is frustrating because that was not the segment I wanted to play. Let me see if I can get to it, where the president is talking about the economy, and he's very, very
on destroying ISIS. Over the top claims that this is World War III.
We'll just go through this.
Just play
part,
into their hands.
Play this a little bit before, but it'll come in too.
Masses of fighters on the back of pickup trucks, twisted souls plotting in apartments or garages. They pose an enormous danger to civilians. They have to be stopped. But they do not threaten our national existence. That is the story ISIL wants to tell. That's the kind of propaganda they use to recruit. We don't need to build them up to show that we're serious. And we sure don't need to push away vital allies in this fight by echoing the lie that ISIL is somehow representative of one of the world's largest religions. We just need to call them what they are, killers and fanatics, who have to be rooted out, hunted down, and destroyed. And that's exactly what we're doing. For more than a year, America has led a coalition of more than 60 countries to cut off ISIL's financing, disrupt their plots, stop the flow of terrorist fighters, and stamp out their vicious ideology. With nearly 10,000 airstrikes, we're taking out their leadership, their oil, their training camps, their weapons. We're training, arming, and supporting forces who are steadily reclaiming territory in Iraq and Syria. If this Congress is serious about winning this war and wants to send a message to our troops and the world, authorize the use of military force against ISIL. Take a vote. Take a vote.
Very powerful part of the speech there, and the failure of the Republican Congress to, to take any action. Whether to authorize military force against ISIL, whether to authorize or not. And I think he was spot on there. And also, if you're going to criticize me for not bombing, well, how come you're not letting me, you're not telling me to bomb? It's kind of a little bit disingenuous because in the past the president hasn't waited for congressional action, has not waited for congressional authorization. But that said, he has a point. I think he's been spot on here. Taking a more measured approach. That is exactly what we need right now. Do not amp things up. You've already got us in enough military theaters. We don't need to be in another one. President gave a really good speech last night. I want to get to the economic aspects of it. I think that was also very powerful. Early on, he talks about poverty. He talks about how to make the system work fairly for everybody. And this is, as he says, the biggest area of disagreement with Republicans. It is the area where I think Democrats have the best chance to really take back our nation politically. Because so many people get how unfair things are. And they know it's unfair because they can feel it's unfair. All right, listen to Ginsburg's show. 844-4-HELD. I'd love to talk to you. 844-367-4251. I know we had some glitches earlier in the show in terms of the broadcast, and I apologize to you for that. I don't have a good answer. I mean, it just happened. These things happen. It's not good. We wish they didn't. They do. And there's nothing I can do about it. Try my best. But the positive is it wasn't all lost. The entire show is being recorded right now, so you can catch it. If you missed what you missed, you can just go right back and listen after the show. I'll post it. So, love to tell you. And by the way, the interview, very interesting with Mike Petrilli, and he certainly sounded good. I think he's just wrong. I think he's just wrong. And some of his arguments are dishonest. And to me, that makes it very, very difficult to take him seriously when he says he cares about working people, when he says he cares about teachers, and that's why he's against mandatory fees to pay for collective bargaining. I have trouble taking him too seriously because he stated something that just simply isn't true, that American teachers are paid comparatively well with their brethren and sisters around the world. We went through the numbers. There are many countries, European countries, Asian countries, where teachers, Canada, where teachers make far more than they do here. So I just don't feel that he's credible when he talks about the value to teachers of eliminating collective bargaining. All right, 844-4-HELG if you want to join me. 844-367-4254. I'm trying to get where the president was when he was talking, you know, about the environment. Because I don't want to – see, here's the thing. I want to save the last hour to really get into some of the Hillary-Bernie stuff. And so I'm trying to get where the president talked about how the economy just is not working, how so many Americans get. It's rigged. And unfortunately, I'm having some trouble finding that. I'm not happy about that fact either. All right, 844-4-L. Let me see. I'm just going to start it around. See if this works. There's been so many issues this morning. I'm not happy about it. Right, that's not where the president should be. That is not where the president was. So we'll see. If we'll give him one more chance here to get to the economy.
What was true then can be true now. Our unique strengths as a nation, our optimism and work ethic, our spirit of discovery, our diversity, our commitment to rule of law, these things give us everything we need to ensure prosperity and security for generations to come. In fact, it's in that spirit that we have made progress these past 7 years. That's how we recovered from the worst economic crisis in generations. That's how we reformed our healthcare system. That's how we delivered more care and benefits to our troops coming home and our veterans. That's how we reinvented our energy sector. That's how we secured the freedom in every state to marry the person we love. But such progress is not inevitable. It's the result of choices we make together. And we face such choices right now. Will we respond to the changes of our time with fear, turning inward as a nation, turning against each other as a people? Or will we face the future with confidence in who we are, in what we stand for, and the incredible things that we can do together? So let's talk about the future. And four big questions that I believe we as a country have to answer, regardless of who the next president is or who controls the next Congress. First, how do we give everyone a fair shot at opportunity and security in this new economy? Second, how do we make technology work for us and not against us, especially when it comes to solving urgent challenges like climate change? Third, how do we keep America safe and lead the world without becoming its policeman?
All right, now, I like what the president's saying here a lot. And you can see the stony-faced Republicans, Marco Rubio, these are just such, I mean, they're just so hateful. They're so hateful. Presidents say we need to make sure everyone has an opportunity. Friggin' Marco Rubio sitting on his hands, a piece of garbage. You gotta vote for the Democrat. I've got my issues with Hillary. She's so much better than any of these cons. There's no question about it.
And not what's worse.
I mean, and just think of how awful it would be. You see that smarmy Paul Ryan up there behind President Obama. Can you imagine if there's a Republican? Can you imagine the feeling you'll have, the sickness in your soul, if there's a Cruz standing there with a, I don't know who he's going to pick to run with him, but if he's the Republican nominee. I mean, can you imagine how devastating that is for our country to see them standing up there giving this speech? These boobs, these psychopaths. It's terrifying. It's so frightening.
Let me start with the economy and a basic fact. The United States of America, right now, has the strongest, most durable economy in the world. We're in the middle of the longest streak of private sector job creation in history. More than 14 million new jobs, the strongest 2 years of job growth since the 1990s, an unemployment rate cut in half. Our auto industry just had its best year ever. That's just part of a manufacturing surge that's created nearly 900,000 new jobs in the past 6 years. And we've done all this while cutting our deficits by almost three quarters. Anyone claiming that America's economy is in decline is peddling fiction. Now, what is true? And the reason that a lot of Americans feel anxious is that the economy has been changing in profound ways. Changes that started long before the Great Recession hit. Changes that have not let up. Today, technology doesn't just replace jobs on the assembly line, but any job where work can be automated. Companies in a global economy can locate anywhere. And they face tougher competition. As a result, workers have less leverage for a raise. Companies have less loyalty to their communities. and more wealth and income is concentrated at the very top. All these trends have squeezed workers. Even when they have jobs, even when the economy is growing, it's made it harder for a hard-working family to pull itself out of poverty, harder for young people to start their careers, tougher for workers to retire when they want to. And although none of these trends are unique to America, they do offend our uniquely American belief that everybody who works hard should get a fair shot.
All right, I'm going to stop it there. We got John. I want to get to John in a second. I just want to make this point. What the president just said, that I'm going to repeat it for you because it's so important. What is true, and the reason that a lot of Americans feel anxious, is that the economy has been changing in profound ways. Changes that started long before the Great Recession hit. Changes that have not let up. Today, technology doesn't just replace jobs on the assembly line, but any job where work can be automated. Companies in a global economy can locate anywhere, and they face tougher competition. As a result, workers have less leverage for a wage, for a raise. Companies have less loyalty to their communities, and more wealth and income is concentrated at the very top. So you're, yes, yes, yes. Why are you for the TPP? Why are you for more free trade agreements, President Obama? Why aren't you for bringing jobs back here by making it relatively more expensive to sell goods manufactured overseas, to sell services that are originating overseas? Why don't you simply make it more expensive through tariffs and bring those jobs right back here? I don't understand this, John. Do you understand it, John? He diagnoses the problem perfectly, and yet he supports a policy that will exacerbate it.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, the only thing I can think of is there's got to be something in there that is, you know, that he doesn't think is all that bad. I don't understand. But, you know, at one point I thought the TPP was sort of a concession for getting Obamacare, you know, kind of like it was never actually negotiated, you know, formally, just that it was kind of unwritten that, you know, you guys give me Obamacare, you leave it alone, I'll give you the TPP. And so that's kind of
it was a quid pro quo that is finally coming due. The bill for the quid is finally coming due today. That's your view. Maybe. It's possible.
Yeah.
Seems a little far-fetched because what if, you know, it's a little far-fetched, but I'm not ruling it out. Is that why you called, John, or did you have some other comment you wanted to make?
No, I had a couple other comments. I just wanted to say this news, these new polls that are coming out, I am delighted and I'm shocked and I'm optimistic now. It's awesome.
I feel exactly the same way. I was amazed. You said shocked. I am with you. I did not expect this to happen, for everything to narrow so quickly. And we're not just talking in Iowa. We're not just talking about the solidification of Sanders' lead in New Hampshire. We're talking nationally. The New York Times poll has Clinton up by only 7 across the nation. The IBD tip has her up by 4, which is basically a dead heat, I guess. That is, I mean, do you,
well, not only that, how
go ahead.
New Hampshire and Iowa can give him early momentum.
Absolutely. No question. Absolutely. If he's real close before those two states and he wins them, then, you know, it's clearly anybody's ball game.
Nevada, right? And Nevada is next, and he's focusing, he's been spending a lot of money there.
Yeah, that's one of the issues that the Clinton team are concerned with, is they expected they could overwhelm Sanders with big ad buys, and they certainly have tried in Iowa, but he's got enough. He's on the airwaves. He's on the radio stations. He's on TV, and he has also built in advertising, marketing, promotions through those big rallies he has, right? I mean, he draws 5,000 people to a cornfield somewhere. That's a chunk of voter, you know, some of them obviously will go to the caucuses, but they tell their friends that's built-in advertising. That's better than any TV ad he could run. And she cannot, simply cannot generate crowds that are as big or even close to as big as his.
And you know what else? I think, you know, Democrats especially are becoming wise to the fact that you can judge who's got more money by the television ads too. You know, it's like I think it probably those attack ads probably backfire when it comes to our part of the electorate.
I think you're right. I think these enlisting Chelsea Clinton to go out there and tell people that Sanders wants to take away their Affordable Care Act coverage, which is patently false. His plan is to replace the Affordable Care Act with universal single payer, which would be significantly better, much better. So Clinton, yeah. Chelsea is lying. I mean, I don't know how else to phrase it. I don't even want to say that because I'm trying to be more sympathetic to Clinton, but she is misstating, she's misrepresenting Bernie's position. I think that hurts. People see through that. They're even saying, John, and I'll let you get right back on, that, you know, the people who go, the young women who are activated by Chelsea, who are activated by Lena Dunham, are saying, well, you know, we are excited by these surrogates coming to our town, coming to our coffee shop, but we're not sold on Clinton. We're not sold on Hillary.
Now, Hillary's obviously, her main concern here is winning this election, and it's not so much the American people. And I think that people are kind of, seeing that. That's not the reason I called in, though. Can I share something with you? It's just a little analogy that I thought of to deal with these people who are like, you know, Bernie or bust, you know, or the I'm not voting for either party people. I was talking to somebody the other day, and I thought, can you imagine what it would have been like, what the outcome of World War II would have been if we had decided not to get involved, right? Because what we really did was, like, we had to ally with Russia, and we didn't like the commies, but we had to ally with them to get rid of the worst of two evils, right? We had to get rid of the Nazis first, and we had to ally with the communists to do it. And then once that fight was over, we had a long cold war with the communists, and we won. And so I kind of see it the same way, as if you view the Democratic Party and the Republican Party as being toxic, well, it's pretty easy to prove that one's more toxic than the other, but it's also easy to prove that siding with the lesser of two evils, at least temporarily, is beneficial. And, you know, you need one to wipe the other out, and then you can start chiseling away at the other one when you're done, you know?
I think you gotta vote. Look, unless, I mean, I just don't see how you don't vote. I mean, the examples people give for voting against both parties, both candidates, because we want to avoid the lesser of two evils, seem to me to prove how important it is to vote for the less bad candidate. And the greatest example is 2000. The harm that George W. Bush did while in office is incalculable, John. And those who made a statement by voting for Nader, what did you state? What did you get for it? You got nothing. You got Bupkis. There's been no rush for a third party candidate. No one said, oh, well, good, we're going to now vote green because Ralph Nader got 2% of the vote. And yet the harm is just, so there's been no clear benefit, and the damage is just striking, stunning. Humans have suffered greatly. There are many people dead, they are dead because of the Ralph Nader movement in 2000. So I just don't know how you can look at this, and you can say all you want. Well, it's a system. It's a bad system. We shouldn't have to vote for the lesser two evils. We shouldn't have an electoral college. We shouldn't have an election where you can win without a majority of the votes. That's all true. So what? So what? You have to do what you can do given this environment. And given this environment, as bad as Hillary Clinton is, and I don't want to overstate it. I think too hard on her, John. But even if you really dislike Hillary Clinton, as in sometimes I don't like her very much, it doesn't matter. The environment in which we live politically requires us to vote for the Democrat in the election for president coming up this year.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. And that's what I try to tell people when I use that analogy, is that it's yes, you have two political entities here that are, you know, quite toxic to the country, but one is worse than the other. That's obvious. It's easy to prove. And you need one to defeat the other, you know, to defeat the worst one first. And then, and only then, is it safe to go after the other one. Because imagine if we had gone to war, here's the even better analogy, if we had gone to war with both Russia and Germany at the same time, how would that have panned out? It wouldn't have been good, you know?
Yeah, we would have lost, so, and the whole world would have gone totalitarian. John, do you see, and I think this is something to also point out, when people say, you know, I'm not going to vote for Hillary if that's their view, I think Bernie has real, even... And I'm usually one of those people, and I've talked about Ed Schultz said one time, I want to win. I'm about winning. I'm not about moral statements. I'm not about moral victories. I'm about victories, period. Well, that's how I feel too. But I think we have to look right now at Bernie's campaign and say he's already achieved some real victories, not moral ones. And what I give specifically as examples are that the Democratic candidate, whoever he or she will be, is going to be against the Keystone XL pipeline, and generally has come out against expanding the areas where we drill for fossil fuels. They also are competing now, and I don't think this would be the case without Sanders, for who can be tougher on the big banks. He's tougher, but she's at least in the fray trying to say, well, I'm tough too, and is presenting some reasonable restrictions, although not enough. They both oppose the TPP. That's a big deal. You know, they all opposed the TPP. That was not the case until Bernie was really nipping at Clinton's heels. And finally, she has now come out in favor of a 4% income tax surcharge on the wealthiest Americans. I think that's a big deal. That is not, that ain't hey, that's meaningful. So I think we have to say, you know, those of you who don't like the current political system, you don't like the Electoral College, well, I'm with you. But in this one election cycle, we have seen it work to push the Democrat to definitely more palatable positions when it comes to corporate elites.
Most definitely. Most definitely. And I think you would also agree that the more likely candidate to go back on some of these promises is Hillary Clinton.
Oh, yeah. I don't trust her fully by any means. I agree with you. She is not necessarily sincere, but still, it is tough. You stake out a position. Even if you're going to move to the center, you're still being tugged back. People are still saying, yeah, you made that promise. You know, her advisor is still saying, well, you know, we don't want you to keep that promise, but you can't move too far away from it either. And so I think those are important factors.
You're right. Bernie deserves credit for that. He deserves credit for her taking those positions.
He does. And we deserve credit for making him very competitive, for making him, you know, close to I don't want to say it that way, but I guess the best thing to say right now, you'd have to say he's close to being a legitimate threat to take the nomination from her.
I think, and we were talking about this yesterday before we knew the results of, you know, the polls that were coming out, I think the current trend is still moving in his favor.
No question.
And I think that that's what it's going to take, and I think Hillary right now is very, very worried.
Oh, no question. No question. I mean, she's attacking him. And by the way, why shouldn't she? Look, she's making the issue, guns a big issue. I don't blame her. I know you like him on guns more than you like her. There's a real difference between the two. He is definitely less progressive on guns. That may help him in the general election. I don't deny that. But personally, I prefer her stances. And I think she's absolutely right to bring this up, to make this a campaign issue. Bill Press is criticizing her for, you know, oh, suddenly she discovered guns. No, she's always been much more pro-gun control. And look, this is the issue she's got. She's got to play that card. I don't blame her for it.
Yeah, I guess that's, you know, one area where liberals really like, you know, her, a little bit of consistency on her part. But I just don't think Bernie's all that bad on guns. You know, he's still pretty strong on gun control.
He did vote against that Brady bill. That's been very, very helpful in terms of reducing crime. And he did vote against liability for the makers, which I think would have led to the best argument for holding them liable, I think, is that they would have to put in these safe gun technologies, right? They'd have to be starting to look at the fingerprint scanners. So only the registered. Go ahead.
Well, part of that bill was also not just the manufacturers, but it was people who,
the sellers.
You know, like a small business that sells guns, they would have, you know, if they had sold a gun to somebody who, I don't know, was a straw purchaser, ended up giving it to, you know, somebody else, and that, you know, it's maybe he just felt it was a slippery slope.
Yeah, I mean, you have to look at Sanders and say this is one area where he's been compromised. The NRA has been an ally. The NRA helped him get into Congress in the first place, supported him over his opponent when there was an open seat in Vermont. I think that was in 1990, 92, something like that. I don't remember the year. And he has been pretty staunch. I know he got a D-minus rating and all that, but he still hasn't completely broken with the gun lobby, even in cases where most Americans disagree.
Can I ask you this?
Sure.
Can I ask?
Yes.
Do you think his record on guns over the year? Do you think he's done what Vermonters wanted him to do?
Hold on one sec, John. Don't go anywhere. Caller, just wait. Let me get to you. I'll get to you right after John. The question is from John. By the way, you're listening to the Hal Ginsberg Morning Show. The time is just running away. I had a tough, I'll be honest with you folks, a little bit of a rocky 2 hours. There was a period of time when we were off RadioMonterey.com, which, by the way, greatly appreciate being part of their lineup. RadioMonterey.com, home of shows for the open mind. And, so first of all, thank you. Stay tuned after my show. Julie King comes on. But a little bit of a rough couple hours there, lost the audio, had some trouble with the clips from the State of the Union, but now we're really rolling along. John's question was, do I think he's done what Vermonters want? I would have to say probably not. I think that most Vermonters probably did support the Brady Bill. Most Americans do want mandatory background checks. The Brady Bill didn't prevent anybody who lawfully had the right to purchase a weapon from getting one. It simply said, we're going to have a background check. He opposed that. Perhaps there was some groundswell from gun sellers in the state of Vermont against the liability law. But my understanding of it was that law would have, you know, as long as you followed all the requirements, as long as every time a buyer came in, you documented that you put them through the mandatory check, I think you'd be okay, John. So my guess is he did not act in the way that most of his constituents wanted. But that doesn't mean he wasn't bowing to political pressure. The fear, of course, is if he had voted for the Brady Bill, if he had voted for liability, that the NRA would pour money into trying to defeat him. So even though he took a position that most Vermonters wanted, he could be attacked on other grounds, and I think that's what he was afraid of, to the extent I
think. Yeah.
Or maybe it was loyalty. Maybe it was loyalty to the gun makers. I don't know. The lobby. I don't know.
That's fair.
Thanks for
final
word.
Yeah, hey, take care. I'll talk to you another day.
All right, appreciate that very much. Great call from John. We've got a new caller on. Who's the new caller?
This is Glenn.
Glenn, good morning.
Good
Glenn,
morning.
Were you sending me? Were you the one who was live tweeting the debate last night? I wasn't sure.
I was not.
Okay, somebody
anything.
Was.
I was texting.
You were texting me. That's what you were doing. You were live messaging me. That's what I should be saying. You were live messaging.
Yes.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you for that. I didn't watch it. I only went back this morning and went over all of it and took notes and copiously.
I watched, and I
messed it up. I had trouble all morning with it. Go ahead. What were you going to say?
Bernie Sanders won the debate last night.
That's what happened.
Well, there was a, what did I say, debate? Where you were live messaging the State of the Union. There was no debate.
Yes.
There was a State
yes,
of the Union. You were live messaging it. How did Bernie Sanders win that State of the
Bernie
Union?
Bernie Sanders won the State of the Union / debate last night. For sure. Did you didn't watch any of it or the after, the stuff that came after?
I did watch.
He got 10 to 15 minutes solid interview time on CNN following the debate, and Hillary got zero.
Oh, wow. I didn't know any of that. Wow. Are you sure?
Hillary
would not MSNBC.
Hillary was not there. She was not shown once on TV during the talk.
Why did they do that? That's awesome.
Why did they
We're
going
to have to hear that. You know, I was going to play Joe Biden, but I appreciate your... Why would they do that?
He had a 10 to 15 minute interview with one of the lead commentators on CNN, the Wolf Blitzer show, afterwards. So Wolf Blitzer and there's Dana Bash.
Here we go, Dana Bash. So here we go.
Yeah.
Why would they? Let's see if we can get this to work here. I've had so many problems.
Well, it was 15 minutes. I don't want to hang out waiting
that
for that.
We could
so
have
anyway,
bipartisan
but what I wanted
support,
to say
but
is,
the truth is, Republicans.
Hillary
are not
ran an ad last night.
Okay.
During Hillary ran an ad on gun control that aired. And they showed that during his interview, and they showed a bunch of things during his interview, and I feel like he responded very well to everything. You should watch it.
I'm going to. Not I'm going to watch. I'm going to play it. What the
I
heck? I might as well watch it and play it.
Think,
Go ahead.
I actually think the State of the Union and the commentary afterwards might very well have given him the bump he needs to win Iowa. And well, New Hampshire, I hope he wins for sure. If he loses New Hampshire, I'm really upset. But I think that gives him the bump to win Iowa. I think it really made him look fantastic.
All right, this is added. Wait, that's January. Okay, so that's not. This was okay. So you're see. Okay, I was looking at the wrong thing. That was State of the Union. Was this an interview with Dana Bash you're talking about? Where was this? Where he was coming?
I don't know who it is. It was some woman from CNN. After the show, I didn't see anything on. I mean, I didn't watch Fox, but I watched CNN, and I watched the MSNBC commentary afterwards. I went back and forth. The MSNBC commentary afterwards, you know, they have Van Jones and David Axelrod and a whole like. It's like
Paul
Begala. Like
it was. I saw Begala. I saw Van Jones. And then I saw two Republicans whom I did not know.
Well, on CNN, they just have Wolf Blitzer and a couple other people talking, and one of them interviewed live Bernie Sanders afterwards, and it was fantastic. It was at least 10 minutes of an interview, and Hillary Clinton, and he was shown frequently taking notes during the State of Address or in the audience. And she wasn't shown at all. I don't even know if she was there.
I was wondering that as well, because I thought they would at least go to her, and they did not show her.
Yeah.
All right. Let me go, because I have got to do a few little errands here. Thanks for the call, Glenn. Appreciate it very much, and some insight there. I'm a little skeptical that they interviewed. I mean, Bernie had a State of the Union conversation, but that was last week, so I'm not clear if Glenn is referring to exactly what I think he might be referring to. Let's go to a break here. I'm going to see if I can get that video for you. I actually have, you know what, forget about the break. This is what I really wanted to play. This is what I had queued up. This is Morning Joe yesterday, and I think this is very instructive as well. So here is Mika Brzezinski on Morning Joe.
So Vice President Biden, this sort of stuck out, right? And I asked this morning because we were going to lead with something else. And then I said, Gene, what do you think? And he said that was the most surprising thing he'd seen in the past 24 hours. Vice President Biden making good on his promise to stay in the mix throughout the Democratic primary. And in an interview last night, he offered this patently frank explanation about why the Democratic primary feels closer than so many predicted.
I think that Bernie is speaking to a yearning that is deep and real, and he has credibility on it. And that is the absolute enormous concentration of wealth in a small group of people, with the middle class now being able to be shown being left out.
But Hillary's talking about that as well.
Well, it's relatively new for Hillary to talk about that. Hillary's focus has been on other things up to now, and that's been Bernie's. No one questions Bernie's authenticity on those issues.
And they question hers, you think?
Well, I think they question everybody's who hasn't been talking about it all along. But I think she's come forward with some really, really thoughtful approaches to deal with the issue.
So, translation, Joe, her message is not authentic, and Bernie's is. I mean, I don't know how else to look at that.
I think Brzezinski's right. I mean, it's very harsh. Joe Biden, this was yesterday morning, okay, or early, late Monday. But Biden was explaining the Sanders surge, and he said, well, he's talking about income inequality, and people believe him. And then Hillary's questioning him on issues as well, but no one doubts his sincerity, and I think that includes on guns. I don't think people doubt Bernie's sincerity on guns. I think that they don't like his position, but they don't feel that he's lying to them or that he's shining them on. That's what Biden said. But when it comes to income inequality, sure, Clinton's talking about, but people doubt her sincerity. And Brzezinski says, isn't his point, isn't Biden's point, Hillary's not credible. I don't know how else to hear that either. I think Brzezinski's right. I think that explains a huge part of the Sanders surge, is that people don't really trust Hillary Clinton. She can say it's the vast right-wing conspiracy. She can say it's not fair. Her backers can say, you know, she really is on the side of the working people. But the record just doesn't speak loud and clear that that is who Hillary Clinton is. Let's go to Harvey. You've been waiting patiently, Harvey. I'll get back to this clip in a moment. Harvey, good morning. In Berkeley.
Hi, of course. Of course, I'm reading a headline here on the Google, and you can look it up yourself. It says, gun violence costs America more than $229 billion every year. We pick up the tab. The taxpayers pick up $229 billion tab every year to pay for medical care, to pay for people who can't work anymore, to pay for their families because they're disabled. Whatever it is, we're picking up the tab. Meanwhile, the gun industry, they're the poster child for privatizing the profit and socializing
the loss. All right, I'm with you. I am totally horrified by the gun makers. I think there's a special place in hell for them. They profit from death. They're merchants of death. So let's make it about this election. Does Clinton, I think she has a better position on guns than Sanders. I assume you do too. Does that fact cause you to support her over him?
No.
Because it's not enough.
I don't trust her. I don't know why, but I just that feeling, that gut feeling, after the Clinton White House, after the all the things that went down, including NAFTA, and I just don't feel that she's the right person. I think Bernie's the guy. I project Bernie as the winner.
But doesn't it bother you? Does it bother you? It bothers me, Harvey, that Bernie has not voted consistently in our interests and against the gun makers and against the gun lobby. He's not perfect, right?
Isn't
that what we have to say, is that he's not ideal. He's not perfect.
You have to remember that he comes from Vermont, and Vermont is where people actually hunt. They actually hunt, not each other. They hunt.
I got
deer.
It. Hold on
they
a sec. Don't
animals.
Go anywhere.
So it's a whole difference.
Okay, hey, Nashville Carl, just wait a sec. I'm going to get to you in just a moment, but I want you waiting around with the phone ringing. So, Carl, yes, I think Bernie has some excuses for his votes against the Brady Bill and against liability for makers. But that said, I lost Harvey. Wow, Harvey just dropped off. So let me just finish what I was going to say, even though Harvey's not here anymore. I think he has some excuses, but, you know, look, she's better. To me, she's better on this issue. Carl, good morning. What's on your mind?
Hey, good morning. You know, it is odd that that is the thing that you picked up doing that in that interview. It's not either here or there. The thing that I picked up during that whole Biden interview, it's funny that you would pick up on something that would be shown to discourage a little bit people for trusting or voting for Hillary Clinton. That's the thing that you picked up on. And you know what I picked up on in that interview?
Go ahead.
when Biden was talking about his financial problems that he was having with his son passing and not, you know, being sick, and President Obama offering to pay for their house if they had to sell it. He's telling them, don't sell it. I'll buy it. I'll give
I,
you the
I was not aware of that. I didn't hear that part of the interview or see it, but I'm glad you brought it yeah. up. The president, yeah. look, he's a good man. President Obama is a good, caring, kind person. There's no question about it. And Joe Biden, let me just say this. Joe Biden is pretty yeah. cool because he's one of the only guys in Congress who's not a millionaire. The only other one I can think of is Bernie and Debbie Wasserman Schultz. There's three. Schultz is yeah. not rich. Biden's not rich. And Sanders is not rich. And I think that's to their credit that they haven't used politics to enrich themselves.
And to me, that encapsulized what President Obama has been since he started running, what he is right now, what he's always going to be, and what history is going to think of this man. This man offered to pay for another man's house to keep him from having to sell his family home because of his dying son's medical bills, and he's not going to be able to pay for it through health insurance. If that right there is not enough to get people off their asses to vote for Democrats and understand what the Republican Party would do to us, that right there should be enough. But if people don't vote for Hillary if she so win the nomination because whatever reason, and they let one of those monsters get into the White House, then you know what? I will cease to call. I will cease to put my opinion. I will put my family before anything else in this country because you deserve exactly what you get. If people that voted for Nader didn't learn their lesson, Nader, we got Bush. An assassin killed RFK, we got Nixon. If you people don't wake up and leave this grudge against Hillary Clinton for whatever reason, or Bernie Sanders for that matter, then you know what? You deserve exactly
well,
what you get.
Am I throwing you for a loop today? Carl, I've actually said pretty much, I've been pretty complimentary, or certainly not nearly as negative as usual towards Clinton, and I've several times insisted that we must vote for the Democrat, whether it's Sanders or Clinton, or for that matter, O'Malley. So I must be confusing you. Wait, one more point. And I'm very, very complimentary of the president's State of the Union. I thought it was outstanding. I give him an A.
Right, me personally, I'm of the mind of this, and I've always been in the mind. You do not have to tear down, not you. I'm using the word you as general. They don't think this is personally coming at you. You do not have to tear down Hillary Clinton to build up Bernie Sanders. Because guess what? Bernard Sanders stands up on his own two feet. His qualifications to be president of the United States is infinitely better than anything the Republicans have to have. And I'm not just saying that just settle for Bernie Sanders. No. This man is infinitely capable, qualified, and would be a great president. Not only a good president, he will be a great president. I am not disputing or debating that. My point has always been, don't do the Republicans.
I get that. By the way, I get that. I've never suggested that you dislike Sanders, or you don't think he'd be a good president, or you're angry or resentful because I'm taking Hillary. Oh, because I'm taking Sanders over Hillary. Your problem with me, I know what your beef is. You don't like the fact that I'm frequently very negative about Clinton. You don't like that, and you don't like it when I'm negative about Obama. I get that. We have different styles. I don't think I'm unfair, but I'm making the point. I think that I am fair because today, for example, I've been clear on this. She's better than he is, in my view, on guns. And she's gotten a bit of a raw deal, I think, from the media on her family leave act plan, which I think is better, frankly, than the other Democrats. And, yes, I have taken issue with President Obama on a lot of occasions.
Remember,
but he gave a great speech. There's no question about it.
Hey, I'm going to toot my damn horn and toot it proudly and loudly. You remember months ago, for months and months, I keep telling you that Hillary Clinton is going to govern and run to the left. She's going to have to because the country has moved that way. Remember me keep constantly telling you that.
Yeah, I know.
You validated my argument by talking about all the things that she has to move.
I know.
Left.
I knew you were going to say that. I saw that one coming. I saw the Carl patting himself on the back train rolling down the track.
Exactly, because I'm right. I'm very right, because the country is in a... I remember listening to right-wing radio for years, and one of the things that always would come out of their mouth, you know, the country is center-right. It just is. And then they'll go on. Do you notice they don't even say that anymore? Do you notice that they don't even use that phrase anymore? They can't, because the country has moved on and left.
Let me ask you this. You did predict this, so I give you credit for correctly predicting Clinton's move to the left, but don't you attribute that in part to the surprisingly strong challenge that, at least from her perspective, I think it's surprising that she's facing from Sanders? And wouldn't you agree that were it not for Sanders, she probably wouldn't have moved so far to the left?
No, I don't believe it's Sanders. I believe it's the country. The country allowed a guy like Bernie Sanders to legitimately Now, me and you would have loved to seen a Bernie Sanders be president 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago. But the country has moved to the left, and it has allowed a democratic socialist to be...
Wait a second. I'll push back. LBJ, 50 years ago, the president was Lyndon Baines Johnson.
I didn't mean to go back that far.
Okay.
I meant 30 years. I meant 20, 30 years.
Okay.
I digress.
Because really, Sanders cut his teeth on a very, very progressive income tax. And
Right. I digress on that. I'm talking about the era of big government is over. That type of thinking is over. That type of thinking you cannot be a Democrat to run for president.
Before I let you go, I got a question for you. Do you have some? And I mean, it's a little bit weird question to ask you because you've been much more supportive of Clinton than I have been. But I feel a little bit of sympathy for her right now. I really do. I mean, she's operating on the assumption she's going to get the nomination, I think, and she's acted pretty much like she's just supposed to get the nomination, be handed to her.
Now she's in a fight of her life. I don't think she's acting like that at all. I believe you're very wrong on that. I don't think she has assumed anything.
Do you have sympathy for her plight?
No, I don't have any sympathy for her plight because she's running for president of the United States. We need to do a DNA test on her. Right. No sympathy for her. You want the tough job, then you got to put the big boy pants on and get in there and get it. You have to take it. You have to want it. You have to make the American people understand that your vision for the country is the best vision. And I think last night the President Obama, when people stop back and look at his legacy, they're gonna be blown away, because we have been clouded by this dark shade of the Republican Party down in everything he's done. I mean, don't believe your cheating eyes. We gained $292,000 last.
He's done some unemployment. Yes, yes.
He does some very, very
yes.
good things.
And maybe Paris will be his greatest legacy. Paris, maybe. Maybe the Affordable Care Act. Let me.
There's a whole lot of things.
I want to direct you. He's done some good things. It's very good things. So, you know, I have my differences as well. No question about it.
Think about this for a minute. Do you think that Governor Snyder, if it wasn't for him really pushing back on the environmental thing that the Republicans have been lying about for years, if you ride through places, you see wind turbines now. Governor Snyder of Michigan is in trouble. 20 years ago, he would have never had any trouble with this right here. He could have lead poisoned his whole community if he wanted to, and nobody would have said nothing. Now we are environmentally aware in our country, and these things are being brought forth by President Obama, and he will be. He don't even need to be vindicated. No matter what anybody else come on these airways and tell you, the guy has been a great president. And it's a shame that he's not going to realize that.
Yeah, I'm mixed. I'm mixed on him, Carl. We don't fully share that. I'll let you go, buddy. Thanks. Thanks for a great call. Talk to you tomorrow or soon again. That's Carl in Nashville. And I did kind of cut him off there, but he's been talking for a while. I got a lot of time, and I give him a lot of time. He's a great caller. 844-4-HELGY, 844-367-4254. I'm just going to power on to the end of the show. I saw Douglas called from Oakland, so if he wants to call in, I'd love to talk to you. 844-4-HALGY. And if you never called, please, I'd love to talk to you. If you're a first, you've never called. I know there are people who have never called because I get your emails. I get your messages, so you definitely are listening. So give me a call if you've never called. Hey, if you've never reached out to me, even better. 844-4-HALGY. Here's what Carl was talking about. A moving moment. Joe Biden on CNN.
Nothing to fall back on is salary. And I said, but I worked it out. I said, but Jill and I will sell the house. We'll be in good shape. When he got up, he said, don't sell that house. Promise me you won't sell the house. He's going to be mad at me saying this. He said, I'll give you the money. Whatever you need, I'll give you the money. Don't, Joe. Promise me. Promise me. I said, I don't think we're going to have to anyway. He said, promise me. And then I'll never forget the eulogy he delivered for Bo. And when Bo had his stroke, when they had a stroke and they thought it turned out it was the beginning of the glioblastoma, and he came running down the hallway in his shirt sleeves, said, Joe, is he okay? His love of family and my family and my love of his family, you know, his two children and my granddaughters are best friends. His number two daughter, my number three granddaughter, they vacation together, they play on teams together, they sleep at each other's homes all the time. It's really, it's personal. It's family.
Yeah, it's very nice. And, you know, that President Obama is just, he is a good person. He's a good, kind, decent man. I don't think there's any heart. I don't know that we could possibly see it differently. All right, if you want to join me, 844-4-HELGY, 844-367-4254. Regarding the interview, regarding the presidency going forward, yeah, I think it's clear. And was it Gloria Borger there interviewing Biden that he sees Clinton as less sincere, less credible when it comes to one of the defining issues of our time, wealth inequality, economic injustice. All right, let's go back to Morning Joe. People are criticizing Brzezinski and Scarborough for being in the tank again. They're in the tank for Sanders. They don't like Clinton. I get it. Look, she's taken, and he was a Republican congressman. I don't know what Brzezinski's politics are. Her father was a Secretary of State, right, for Jimmy Carter. They don't like her. A lot of people don't. A lot of people don't like her, and they do, or at least Joe clearly likes Bernie as a person. That is true. That's something you got to keep in mind. But is their analysis pretty on spot on? I think it is.
Well, that's the message when he says, well, she's relatively new to being worried about people that are poorer than the rich, income disparity, which is, of course, the most important issue right now, not only the Democratic Party, but a lot of economists would say in America. And she's flip-flopping on a lot of other issues. But there's no doubt Joe Biden has said that he's haunted every day by the decision that he made not to run. He sees that Hillary's behind in a lot of polls. She's behind in Iowa. She's behind by a large amount in New Hampshire. He sees polls where Hillary Clinton does worse against Donald Trump than Bernie Sanders. And there is no doubt about it, and we have talked about this, Gene Robinson, mm-hmm. The question is not what happens to Hillary Clinton running against Bernie Sanders in South Carolina after she loses Iowa and New Hampshire, if she loses Iowa and New Hampshire. The question is that when Joe Biden and John Kerry, who have been privately thinking about this, discussing it with friends, even Al Gore, who friends say has been obsessed with the issue of whether he should jump in the race or not, do they see that weakness as an invitation to open this race as wide open as Republicans will open the race up if Donald Trump wins Iowa and New Hampshire?
too.
Well, you know, on the Democratic side, let's be real. I mean, Hillary Clinton has a very good chance of winning both those first states. Now, if she loses both of them, then everybody's going to look at South Carolina. If she had a problem in South Carolina, that would mean that the firewall is not there. That because you have to, she has to underperform according to expectations with African Americans in South Carolina in order to lose that. It'd be very, very hard for her to lose that. But if she got into trouble there, then sure, you'd see a lot of people who've wanted to be president for a long time saying, well, hold on, how is this exactly going
to
work?
Here's where I just want to stop that, and we're going to get to Paul in a second. But and this is where I thought, basically, Scarborough went off the rails, but I still wanted to play that clip because Gene Robinson is buying into this notion that there's a chance that some more conventional Democrat will run if Clinton falters. I don't buy it. I don't see that happening at all. In fact, you just heard the most conventional Democrat that you would think might run would be Biden, right? He's the vice president. How can he be more conventional than that? 30 years in the Senate. And he just said he likes Bernie. Bernie's sincere. People believe what Bernie has to say. The comment when Biden stated, hey, there's not a day I don't regret running. He didn't mean he wishes he had run. He said in the next breath, it was the right decision. Get over it, guys. It's going to be either Sanders or Clinton. There's not going to be another Democrat who's going to enter the race. And if both of them falter, if Democrats say we cannot elect a socialist and suddenly Clinton implodes altogether, then it'll be O'Malley. That's it. There's nobody else. So make your decision based on those three. Let's go to the phones. Paul, thanks for waiting. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Al. It's Tim.
Oh, it's Tim. I'm sorry. I thought, well, I heard Paul. I'm sorry, Tim. Thanks for waiting because I know you're busy this in the mornings. Go ahead. What's on your mind?
Hey, how great would it be if Joe Biden actually came out and fully endorsed Bernie Sanders? I mean, he doesn't have anything left politically, right? He's pretty much done, isn't he?
I would think so. I don't think he's going to run for Senate.
I mean, he's not going to burn any bridges because I think he's going to exit his political, you know, he's decided to end his political career. He's not going to continue on, I don't think.
So does your question presuppose that you agree with me that he's not going to run, that if Clinton starts losing primaries, there's no way he's going to jump in the race?
I don't think so, no.
Yeah. I think it'd be awesome. I'd love to.
I think it'd be foolish. I think if first of all, and let me pat myself on the back, just like Carl patted himself on the back. Hey, haven't I told you, you and John worrying about Bernie Sanders in the polls all these months, and what did I say from the very beginning?
You thought he'd win, and you deserve to pat yourself. I should have given you credit myself. When you came on, I should have said, hey, you know, Tim has been there from very early on saying he thinks Sanders is going to win. Now, it's a little early to take a victory lap. I mean, we haven't even had the caucuses yet, but yes, your prediction is looking a lot better now than it was 2 weeks ago, no question.
So, yeah, you know, I don't think, even if Joe Biden were to run, I don't think they can run anyone. I don't think they can, even if Hillary shoots herself in the foot and they absolutely have to throw someone else in there, they don't stand a chance because Hillary's the best thing they got, and she's not doing it, so... I don't think anybody would.
I agree. I agree with you. The only way I think you get some new entrants is if all three, in other words, Sanders, Clinton, and O'Malley all have some incredibly serious problem. They die.
Right.
They become fatally ill. Somebody becomes indicted. Someone is arrested. Unless that happens, we're going to get one of those three as the Democrat nominee.
Hey, and you know what? Actually, if they had to throw someone else in there to save Hillary Clinton, the only person I think they could, and it wouldn't be bad for us on that end, would be Elizabeth Warren. But I know she doesn't want to run right now. I think she's saving hers for later. So.
Well, the only problem there is she's getting a bit older, too. I think she's 60. I'm so bad, but I'm thinking 65, 66, maybe not quite that old. But I think that's about how old she is. So she could run in the next cycle. She's 66 years old, Tim. She's 66.
Yeah.
She'll be 67 when she'll be 71 when after the first term of whoever wins this year. So, or yeah, this year.
I didn't know she was 66. I thought she was younger than that.
Yeah.
So. But either way,
I'd love to see her come out and endorse Sanders. That would be beautiful too, both her and Joe. But I don't expect that. Who knows? You don't know.
I don't think she's going to, because I don't think her political career is over. I think she wants to continue on right now. So, you know, like Tom Harmon has mentioned, it'd be political suicide, you know, especially if
Wait, hold on. Don't go anywhere. Just one second. I'm going to get you on, Douglas. Just hold on one second. If I have to
Don't worry.
Douglas, just let me finish with Tim. Tim, why would it be political suicide? I've got to understand this from you. Why would it be political suicide if Warren endorsed Sanders?
Well, because if Hillary Clinton can manage to get the nomination, then she'll be blacklisted in the party. She won't be able to get the committee chairs that she wants, things like that.
I don't know. You know what? Elizabeth Warren has a pretty solid constituency, independent of anybody. I think it would be tough if Clinton acted in that way, especially if assuming Warren endorsed Sanders, Clinton wins the nomination, and then Warren gives a beautiful, great speech at the Democratic Convention, goes out and campaigns for Clinton. I think that that would mend the fence. I really do, Tim. Tim, thanks for the call. I'll let you get to work. I want to get
one last thing.
Sure.
Okay. Hey, I just want to say hi to Douglas. Hey, Douglas, I love your calls, man. You're keeping House show afloat.
Hey, Tim, I wish you would stay on the phone. You don't have to hang up.
Then don't hang up. Go ahead, Douglas.
We can handle Hal together, Tim, because I'm also was with –
You both were talking me off the ledges when I was basically sticking forks in Sanders. But you guys are a little bit early to be taking, as I said, victory laps. We haven't even had one caucus.
No, it's not a victory lap. It's just the momentum and the ability to see that Clinton was rejected before, and that Bernie Sanders, it's his time.
Well, that's such a good point. That's a great point, Douglas. I'm going to interrupt here because I agree with you. She has already lost, and that does reflect vulnerability. It reflects weakness. Another point I made to somebody who's a staunch Clinton supporter is, I think her current weakness in the polls really indicates that she's not a great candidate. This is her fourth presidential campaign.
The current weakness in the polls reflect the weakness in the polls that was there all along.
Okay.
Outside of that huge system she has set up. That's all we were reading and looking at the system, the structure. And then now you have a Donald Trump that went outside that Republican structure. They had Jeb Bush, and the Democrats said it's going to be Hillary Clinton. And the people they're rejecting it. As we speak, this is a true reflection of what America is. Bernie Sanders to the left. I mean, that's where America is. America was to the left with Barack Obama. He let him down, but that doesn't mean Americans still aren't to the left.
To the right, are we Donald Trump? Do you see? Because I look at the latest polling, and Trump is the leader. You know, no one thinks he can do it. In Iowa, Cruz had a pretty big lead. He's come back towards Trump. Nationally, Trump has got a much bigger lead over Cruz or anybody else than Clinton has over Sanders.
And for you to listen to what Carl says, America's to the left. Trump is not a Republican. He's not a Republican.
Tim.
He's talking about tariffs. He's talking about
Russia handle Syria and ISIL. We don't need to get him.
Yeah.
Yeah, he said that. Tim, what's your thought on Trump?
You know, I tend to agree too. I don't think he's not a Republican, I still don't even think he's a serious candidate. I think he's there for himself, and so we'll see what happens. But I don't. He's not going to be a Republican nominee, and like Douglas says, he's not a Republican. So I think he's just there for himself.
How is he not the nominee if he's winning by he's doubling basically Cruz right now nationally. He's 36-19 in the New York Times poll nationally. How does he not win the nomination,
Tim? The Republican church has got to figure out how to get rid of Trump. And I don't think it's going to be pretty because they do not like him and they do not like Cruz. They don't like either one of them.
Yeah, that's right. Now, listen, I'll tell you what.
The church is going to figure out a way.
Yeah,
the structure's got to figure out a way to get rid of Trump because, I hate to say this, But Carl's right. America, not just the progressives and the liberals, are to the left. And Trump speaks to the left.
He's more center left
than center right.
Economically, he's a populist. I'll say it that way. I'll tell you what, that's going to do it for the show. I was going to let those guys go for a few moments afterwards, but let's just call it. We're at the very end. There's the theme music. I'll be back tomorrow. Thanks to everyone for calling and for putting up with some technical issues. Let's hope they're all ironed out by tomorrow. Have a great day. I'll be back Thursday morning.